Hi, thank everybody for coming. Welcome. I know a lot of people came from far away, so thank you. I'm Stephanie Molden. I'm from the Yukon Free Press, who is sponsoring this event. I don't know if you've seen our newspapers anywhere. And we're welcoming Derek Jensen, the author of Endgame, Songs of the Dead, The Culture of Make-Believe, and How Shall I Live My Life on Liberating Earth from Civilization. And we're also welcoming my friend Red Moon Song. She's a veteran activist, and she's from an eco-village in North Carolina. She's here to balance Derek's perspective as we talk. I wanted to bring them here because as I've gone through my undergraduate education, I'm graduating soon, I've learned all these things about the world, and I'm having a hard time putting them together into a cohesive perspective. So I learn about things like violence against women, racism, problems we have with the environment now, philosophy, human rights, and how do we put all these things together? Why is that important? How are we going to live our lives when we leave here? And did anybody think about that?
Yeah.
Okay, good. So I met Red Moon Song this summer at her eco village, and she was like, "You need to read Derek Jensen." So I did. As soon as I got home, and every morning I would wake up and be like, "Mom, did you know this about slavery?" And she'd be like, "You're crazy." But it meant a lot to me. And so I do some activism work here at UConn, and I wanted my activist friends up in the corner to get a good new perspective about all the work they're doing. And for everyone else who has. Sounds like a lot of people have heard of Derek Jensen, so maybe a lot of people interested in environmentalism.
Woo.
Yeah? Good. And I wanted anybody who likes to ask the question, why? You know, when you're five and you're like, "Mom, why is the sky blue?" And she's like, "Because it's, you know, this." But you're like, "But why?" And, you know, you learn in school about racism, and your teachers are like, "Oh, well, class, gender, and sex, blah, 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 blah." We're like, "Yeah, but why? Why are people hating each other? Why are they doing this?" And then if we know why, then we can work on fixing it. And that's why I wanted to bring these two wonderful people here to talk to you. So with that, I would like to introduce Derek Jensen.
Okay, so... before we wait, did you take a piece of paper? Thank you. Before we start, I would like to thank people, but before we even start that, I have a piece of advice, which is if you are going to go into the bathroom that is over there, do not go barefoot. It is the most disgusting floor I've ever walked through in my life. Have people been in there? It's like every step your feet are creak, creak, creak. Very bad. So I would like to thank the Yukon Free Press and Red Moon Song and Undergraduate Student Government.
They paid for it.
And also, Stephanie has done something quite extraordinary, which is normally when coalitions bring me it's a coalition of like I was just in Chico 2 days ago, and when I thanked the organization and people who brought me, I thanked like 8 people and 4 organizations. And in this case, the coalition who brought me consisted of Stephanie, and then Stephanie. Actually, I forgot. She also had a lot of help from someone named Stephanie. Okay, so the next thing is, we have discussed 11 times now how we're going to handle this evening, what we're going to do, because some of our options were...
Let Derek talk for 2 hours by himself.
Yeah, and you sleep.
Right.
Or let you talk for 2 hours by yourself and I sleep. Each of us talk for, you know, 20 minutes and then go to Q&A. Or another possibility we're thinking is that we were thinking we could just go straight to Q&A, and that might actually be pretty fun. And your response is absolutely overwhelming. It's just, yeah, it's a great idea, Derek. Really. Fuck, we don't care either. We're now going to discuss it 12 times. So actually what we're thinking is we're thinking that since we live in a democracy, which is actually my best joke of the night.
I guess so.
That we can take a vote. And then we take a vote right now. And then what we do is we take a vote and then we act like it's a real democracy and we just ignore you and do whatever the way
right,
you want.
Right, then
do.
We discuss it.
Unless, of course, any of you have any campaign contributions, in which case we will listen very closely. So do you want to start over with the introduction? So what do you want to do? I think I would kind of prefer that, because we were actually having a great time just chatting. We were thinking we could just ignore you and just chat, and that would actually be a really fun time. What do you all want to do? Would you want to, how many people would want to just sort of go straight? We're going to go the same amount of time anyway. We're going to go probably 2 or 3 hours. So you're not going to get ripped off on time here no matter how we do it. How many people would want to go straight to Q&A? 2? Do you have any money?
Yes. No.
Yeah. Well, then we don't care what you think anyway, do we?
I have other services.
All right.
Yeah. That's great. Okay, so it's looking like they don't really want to go straight to Q&A.
Yeah, it looks that way.
Okay. Half what and half what? I don't know what that means.
You don't know what half and half means?
Well, it has a whole bunch of different definitions. I don't know what it means in this circumstance. What does that mean?
Talk for an hour, you two, amongst yourselves, and then Q&A for an hour, or something like that.
Okay, wait, I need more clarification. Because now are you saying that you'd want like her to talk for a while, me to talk for a while, you want us just to chat like we were before, and then y'all just sort of eavesdrop? Would you want us to do this, like an official talk from each of us for that adds up to an hour?
Make sure this is in triplicate, whatever you are putting down.
Well, we're trying to give them what they want. Remember, you said we need to give them what they want. She said that.
I know.
And I'm trying to figure out what they want. How do you figure out what they want? Communicating. That's what I'm trying to do. Communication.
Can that be?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I don't care. We don't care. I mean, here's the deal. It's your evening because it's like that's a problem with school in general is that when I used to teach, I hate that word, when I used to be an educator, I recognize that the hierarchy in school is entirely backwards. That people always think that the students are basically there to do what the teacher says, who is there to do what the administrators say, who are there to do what the president says. But school is there for students. And so actually it was my job to be the servant to the teacher, the students. And then it was the administrator's job really to be my servant. And yeah, hierarchy, whatever. And then it was the administrator's job, the president's supposed to serve them. I mean, really, school exists for students. And this night exists for you. This night does not exist for me or for you. And so would you want for us to just continue the, I thought, extremely interesting conversation we were having before? Or would you want for us to each do a little presentation?
Presentation.
A familiar format.
Okay. Well, as long as we're doing that, so now, am I supposed to go first? Or are you supposed to go
see,
first?
See, this is the great part about being on stage with a radical feminist, is that they're always saying to you, do you want to go first? You can go first if you want to. Do you want to? Do you want to make that decision? Are you sure that's what we want to do? Do you want to talk about it again?
That's very right. I'm a fucking man.
That's right. Say it.
You go first.
Okay.
You want me to go first? I'll go first. I don't care.
I'll go first.
Okay.
So one of the things that interested me in an article that Derek wrote that I read was about somebody asking about toilet paper, taking shorter showers, blah, 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 and how that's not the answer. And I am a person who is very interested in voluntary simplicity lifestyles. And so I try to encourage people to get as radical as possible in their lifestyles, which means taking shorter showers, paying attention to the toilet paper to use. I rarely even use toilet paper, okay? So I've moved into this next phase, which is a little more radical than the kind of toilet paper used. But that being the way it is, my whole theory is based on a phrase that I use frequently, which is, what you don't spend, you don't have to earn. What you don't spend, you don't earn. So, if you can learn to live a radical lifestyle where you use very few resources, you live in community with your friends, you conserve energy like crazy, you don't have a lot of bills to pay, I don't have utility bills to pay, you don't have all that stuff, and you can live on very, very, very small amounts of money, which means you've got enormous amounts of time. Time to do what you think you are called to do, what you're, in a native way, they'd say, your sacred task. What is your sacred task? And you would have the time to examine that sacred task and prepare for that sacred task and serve your community with whatever your sacred task is, and you'd have enough time to do that. So for me, the whole idea of living a lifestyle of voluntary simplicity has to do with understanding what you really need and what you don't really need. And beginning to move your needs to your wants and your wants to your desires. And then your desires kind of just go off that way someplace else. And so you really know who you are and what you need in order to serve and function in this world. So that's my basic premise. So now we can argue about the details if you want. We could do that. What kind of toilet paper do you use? If it's really soft toilet paper, it's from virgin forests. If it's harder toilet paper, it's from recycled paper. Uh-oh. Restaurant napkins.
I'm on the road. So whenever there's a paper napkin, I always take it home, even after I use it. And then, by the way, after I use it, it goes in the worm bin.
In the worm bin.
Yeah, they love the poop.
Do you take it home? Is that where you have the worm bin?
I poop at home. I don't take this. I don't use this on the road and then take the used toilet paper home.
I'm just asking what you do at your house.
Yeah. Here, this is one I used last night. I agree. And as we were saying earlier, my problem with a lot of the voluntary simplicity people is there are a lot of people who use that as a means to an end, who say that that's a means to an end. That somehow taking a shorter shower or composting is going to stop this corporate culture that's killing the planet. And that's just insane. But I absolutely agree that, I mean, I've written before, but see, we've already gone off our format.
Who cares?
I know. That's it. Because the format's more important than what's happening right now. Damn it. There's a security camera up there. One of the most important things that there's a friend of mine who says that a lot of activists begin by wanting to protect a specific piece of ground and end up questioning the foundations of Western civilization because they're trying to protect this place, but then they start asking, why is this place getting destroyed? And then once you start asking those questions, the questions spiderweb their way out. I know it's the same for a lot of women. They start asking, why do women get raped? And then, women do not get raped.
Right.
Why do men rape women?
That's right.
And then the questions will spiderweb their way out. And you can ask, why does this culture kill indigenous cultures? Questions spiderweb the way out. And for me, in many ways, it started because I didn't want to get a job. And I was in college, and I used to ask people if they liked their jobs. About 90% would say no. And what does it mean when the vast majority of people spend the vast majority of their waking hours doing things they don't want to do? It seemed crazy to me. When I was in college, a lot of my friends were, it's like, we hated school. And in fact, I hated school so much, I went back to grad school twice. We hated school, but I would say, what are you going to do about the fact that you hate school? And I said, well, when I get out, I'm going to buy myself a really nice car. And I had friends who were actually looking forward to the day they would retire when they were 65. And I knew that what would happen is that if I worked for 40 years or however many, and then I retired, the next day I would get hit by a bus. This is just what's going to happen. And so I couldn't see spending my life doing what I didn't want to do. And a lot of it for me came down to the song Taking Care of Business by Bachman-Turner Overdrive, which I heard when I was like 16. And the song changed my life. I mean, so discourse matters. It was pretty funny. I was doing a talk in Edmonton, I think it is, Edmonton, Alberta, and I was saying, I heard this song by this really cheesy, awful rock band, Bachman-Turner. They're from Edmonton. I was like, oh no, actually, the best rock band of all time. Anyway, the song goes, you get up every morning from your alarm clock's warning, take the 8:15 to the city. There's a whistle up above, and are you get up every morning from your alarm clock's warning, take gate 15 to the city. There's a whistle up above, and people pushing, people shove, and all the girls trying to look pretty. Well, if your train's on time, you can get to work by 9, start your slaving job, and get your pay. But if you ever get annoyed, look at me, I'm self-employed. I love to work at nothing all day. Which was just music to my 16-year-old ears. Before then, I was a good capitalist. And then after that, I was like, fuck, I don't want to get... Well, so I didn't say swear at that time. So I was like, darn, I don't want to get a job. And so for me, in some ways, yeah, my environmental concerns began when I was a kid, when I saw subdivisions going in to these beautiful places that I loved. When I was 8 and 9, I recognized you can't have an infinite growth on a finite planet. That's just insane. And then also, you know, with my father's violence, I recognized that, you know, his violence wasn't making him happy. Why are people doing these crazy behaviors that aren't making them happy? And then, you know, that was just, you know, parked in there, some park, that's a car word. That was just resting in there somewhere, waiting to germinate.
Planted,
thank you. It was planted in there. And then the BTO song came along when I was about 16, and that... broke the seed capsule. I'm not going to take this metaphor very much further. And then it took a few more years for it to really sprout. and I'm going to stop now. But the point is that I recognized, I was not at a stage yet where I recognized that I wanted to not get a job so I could serve the larger community. All I knew when I was 20 is I didn't want to get a job. And then it took me through my mid-20s to figure out that what I need to do, that I was given a life, and it is my responsibility to give back something back to my community for that beautiful gift that I've been given. And so it took me, you know, I think that developmentally it's actually pretty appropriate for late teens and early 20s to be as narcissistic as they often are. I don't mean to talk about you like you're not here. But I think that's really important, can be important developmentally. It was for me, because you need to figure out who the hell you are, and you certainly haven't been told the story since you're a child about how to be a human being. And so I had to spend, I know this is true for Terry Tempest Williams too, I talked to her about this at length one time, that I know for me, I spent a lot of my 20s vomiting up the effects of coercive schooling, and trying to figure out what it means to be a human being. And then once I started figuring out in my late 20s, then it's like, okay, what am I going to do about this? And part of being a human being, no, part of being a living being is to serve your community. Mm-hmm. And so take this back to the beginning. That's where I really fall apart with some of the, obviously not you from everything you've said, but where I fall apart with some of the people who think of simple living as an end. Because a compost pile would not have stopped Hitler. And what we need is a culture of resistance, and what we need is serious political organizing, and we need to build a militant resistance that will stop this culture from killing the planet. Militant, non-militant, I don't give a shit.
What do you think of civilian defense? Have you heard anything about civilian defense? It's kind of the thing like they did in Czechoslovakia, I think, in 68 when the Russians came in and the Czechoslovakian people like hid all the street signs. They put all the food underground. So when the soldiers came in, they were totally lost. They had no food. And it was, I think, 100 people were killed before the Russian soldiers left. But the idea of civilian defense being all the people learn from the time that we're children, we learn self-defense, we learn resistance, the exact kind of things you're talking about, the independence that it seems like the soul is, it's necessary for us to be able to create a social system that's much more balanced and where everybody, not the standing army routine, as much as every person within the society having survival skills, knowing these various things so that we can function with more, you know, with more respect for each other as a whole, like having those skills to begin with.
I think that that is crucial, and I think that that has been part of every successful resistance movement that has been. Only 2% of the IRA ever picked up weapons. 98% is doing support work. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. I love to poke fun at pacifists, but Harriet Tubman carried a gun, but the Quakers did not. And what we really need to do is to figure out how to work together. The U.S. Patriots, you know, the four parents, the four parents, one of the things they did, as well as trying to, well, amass their own personal wealth because they were assholes, one of the things that they did was they built up alternate institutions at the same time that they're opposing the British. So they built up their own court system. Do people know this history? Yes? No? Oh, it's fascinating that they built up alternative court systems because they didn't respect the British courts. And one of the things they did is they made, in Massachusetts, and I think in Connecticut, but I'm sure in Massachusetts, they made their own court system that had no enforcement because it didn't have the power of the state behind it, but it had the power of communal enforcement, such that you and I, you say that I trespassed on your property. It's a whole other question of trespassing, but we'll just go with that because I don't want to say I punched you.
Okay.
Well, I don't say I punched you, whatever.
Okay, whatever.
Okay, so instead of taking it to the British court, they would take it to the local court, and then the local court would impose a sentence upon me. And actually, because I'm a male hitting a woman, they probably wouldn't have done anything, but set that aside. The court would have imposed a sentence which the community would have enforced. And so you see this with the Spanish anarchists setting up their own school systems. We've all heard about the Spanish anarchists with their school systems. Mm-hmm. And Kropotkin talked about how so many revolutions have founded on bread because there's no way for the people to feed themselves. And then I'm going to go a different direction and say that D'Argemail, he's great, one of my heroes, D'Argemail did not like how the U.S. government, the corporate media, was covering the invasion of Iraq. He was just a standard person up in Alaska, and he didn't like how the corporate media is covering it. So what am I going to do? I'm going to go cover it right. So he just went over there. And I was talking to him one time, and he told me about the defense of Fallujah. And, you know, Fallujah held out for about 2 weeks against the U.S. military. Mm-hmm. The defense of Fallujah was not organized. It was neighborhood by neighborhood. There was no overarching organization. It was the individual neighborhoods. They picked up their guns, and they're going to stop the U.S. military. And there's a lot to be said for that. And once again, we see that with the IRA. We see that all through history. We see this, the importance of having an entire culture of resistance where everything you do, once again, whether, I mean, Maud Gunn, we talked about her on the way up, was, her son became chief of staff of the IRA and later founded Amnesty International, won the Nobel Peace Prize, when she was, she started really with the Gaelic literature revival. And that's the importance of Gaelic literature for the Irish resistance. Mm-hmm. And then she found that nonviolent resistance wasn't working. And through a generation, because they did the whole Irish land movement, and that succeeded in great measure, but it also had, there were a lot of casualties, and they realized that they needed to move to militant resistance. So my point is that all these are intermeshed.
Mm-hmm. Well, see, this is what happened from me becoming more acquainted with your books this year, because I've been a nonviolent activist for 30 years or whatever. I think the first time was surrounding the Pentagon, was that 1980 or something like that, and I was support for 7 Greenpeace people who were getting arrested who handcuffed themselves together. Don't ever handcuff yourself together in an action, because the police will just kick your hands and you can break your wrists. It's really foolish, but I didn't know that at the time, so I was their support person. And so I've been using that nonviolent support and getting arrested, whatever, at the test site or getting arrested in D.C. or getting arrested in a wide variety of places for what, you know? And so they take you in. I mean, I wrote something last year about spending the night with the Capitol Police because a bunch of us got arrested at a big thing. And they kept us overnight and we were on the buses with our hands, whatever. So I was thinking to myself, what is the point of this? I mean, I'm there to put my body there, okay, because I'm, you know, an old lady, and I think as an old lady I'm supposed to put my body out there. And there was a bunch of other gray-haired people there, too, so it was fine. And it cost $150, and, you know, we got to sit overnight and talk to the Capitol Police, and they didn't even use computers. They were doing everything by hand. And normally I support doing everything by hand because I don't use computers either, but I thought the Capitol Police, you know, that just didn't go with me, right? So I've been rethinking what would be more useful for me. Is it useful for me to continue to get arrested in these nonviolent processes? When I've been doing this, I mean, 40 years, 35, 40 years with friends, and I've been vegetarian. I mean, you know, the whole, all of the above. And so one of the things which reading your stuff did for me is it caused me to start talking to all the people in my community, of course, and people that I've been active with for a long time who are avowed nonviolent people. And it's been causing me to think, what am I willing to do? I mean, from everything I understood about the Gandhi thing, the reason he was able to be nonviolent was because there was other people in the background, you know, just like Martin Luther King, he could be nonviolent because there was somebody saying, by any means necessary, in the background. And so I was thinking to myself, well, how much are the people that I've learned who are able to use nonviolent tactics, that's what I've been taught, nonviolent tactics, to succeed in political stuff, overthrowing the British, what have you, how much has that only been possible because there was this threat from the other side? And so I've really been considering that a lot more and saying, okay, well, what is my place now as a woman who's 64 years old, who's been an activist for a long time? What is my obligation to these next generations? What is my obligation to everything that you're talking about at this point in my life? And so I want to appreciate you for bringing these particular interstitial weavings into my consciousness so that I can reflect on that and act in the way I've been acting, but what might be the next step for me coming from the background I'm coming from, which is I love thought-provoking stuff, so I just appreciate your thought provocations.
Well, thank you for that, and I really appreciate your extensive work and extensive history of work, because that's one of the things also that I think we all need to remember is that we have to be in this for the long haul, even though at this point there is no long haul.
Right.
You know, 120 species went extinct today,
yeah.
And 120 species will go extinct tomorrow, and the day after, and the day after. And there is this tremendous urgency. And at the same time, we have to recognize that there has to be this continuity. It's like, how many people here have seen the movie Battle of Algiers? Great movie, huh? Great movie. Best movie ever on insurgency. And I was watching that movie with a friend of mine, and the movie is about the Algerian insurgency against the French. And I was watching this movie with a friend of mine, and I said, so, who would I be in this movie? And I was just asking for strokes. You know, my friend was supposed to say, oh, you'd be the really brave one. And my friend said, oh, you'd be dead. Yeah, thank you very much. And my friend said, no, you're dead for 30 years, and your books are on the bookshelves of all the insurgents. That one of the things we need to do is we need to build an entire culture of resistance. And part of that has to do with this moving through the understanding. I mean, every resistance, it's so interesting. The French resistance in World War II, you know, a couple of things about it. One of them is that you know, we think about them, you know, bravely attacking the Nazis or whatever, but most of those resistance movements went through an evolution where at first, what you have to do is basically pray for the souls of the Germans and withdraw your support for them and then send them loving kindness, you know, and hope that they will change. And then, oh, didn't work. Okay? Well, it's okay if you let the air out of their tires, but you got to make sure to let them know so they don't, like, try to drive on a flat tire and really bum them out. And then, didn't work. And so they kept moving step by step until by 1944, even the priests were calling for, they're saying it's okay to kill, to assassinate German officers. So there's this evolution that goes through, and you see this consistently. The Movement for the Emancipation of Niger Delta, you know, Ken Saro-Wiwa was a nonviolent activist, and he was murdered by the Nigerian government at the behest of the oil corporations. And his son helped with men making the transition. And men now says to the oil companies and to the employees, it's pretty much a direct quote, it must be clear that the government cannot protect you. Leave our land now or die in it. And they've been able to reduce oil output in Nigeria by 20%. And, you know, they talk about fucking cap and trade, you know. It would be very easy to reduce U.S. oil output by 20%. I asked Dar Jamail how long a bridge would last in Iraq if it wasn't guarded. He said, between 6 and 24 hours. One of the things that my work is really about is about attempting to create a real resistance movement that is commensurate with the problems that we're facing. It's like a couple things. One is, I shared the stage about a year ago with Vandana Shiva, Kathy Pedler, and this nun whose name I never can remember, and she does this great anti-war activism. And we're all of us up on stage are recognizing we don't live in a democracy. And anybody here, okay, here, we're going to have a little vote. How many people think that the U.S. government takes better care of corporations or human beings? Corporation or human beings first? Bunch of fucking communists. How many people think the government takes better care of corporations? I think it's consensus. So I asked. We all understood this on stage, and we all in the audience, and everybody in the audience understood this. And then I turned to the nun to the left of me, and I said, so if you fully internalize the understanding that we don't live in a democracy, and you want to stop the war in Iraq, how would this affect your activism? How would this change how you behave? And she turned to me and said, I have no idea. And we know none of us have any idea, because we're all laboring under this illusion that we live in a democracy. We're all pretending. I mean, that's why I hate those fucking nature programs. A bunch of reasons I hate the nature programs. But one of them is that they always end. It's like, oh yeah, okay, this is being destroyed, write your representative. You know what? I don't have a fucking representative. Representative Mike Thompson, Northern California, he represents Monsanto. Sorry, he doesn't represent me.
Yeah, but legal
represents me. That's a great point. We should shun her. You're the problem with healthcare. And I was reading a great book yesterday on the plane, or day before on the plane. It's called The Rising of the Moon by Flynn Connelly. I really recommend it. It has this cheesy science fiction cover, and there's like cheesy science fiction stuff in the first five pages. But what it's really about is about a feminist revolution in a futuristic papist Ireland. And it's step by step how the women start a revolution. And it's great. And there was a line that she had me thinking because of this. Before we can begin to use power on our own terms, we must realize that we're powerless on theirs. Much of the brilliance of the democratic experiment, that's what we live in, is to con the powerless into believing they have power. When it finally becomes clear to even the most obtuse that we the people are powerless, I can't read my handwriting, powerless in the something something, in this great democracy, the next twist of the screw is to convince us that our power lies in our power to consume or not consume, or in our attempts to become enlightened. But only when we realize that we are powerless in all these ways will we be moved to use the power in ways that really affect change. I think that's one of the big cons we've been faced with, is that the belief that we actually have power within this system. The system has been set up from the beginning to protect those in power. And we all like to laugh at, back in the 1980s, the Soviets, you know, in the Politburo, it was like 98% Communist Party members. Well, what percentage of the U.S. House of Representatives and Senate are Capitalist Party members? You know, it's like, who's laughing now?
100%.
Yeah, 100%. It's worse than the Politburo.
Yeah.
And so there's, I mean, I'm not the first. I mean, Noam Chomsky talked about this with the two-party, one-party system. And it's just... And that's another thing. We get conned all the time in all of our civics classes about, there's all these checks and balances between the different houses of government. Well, let's fuck that bullshit. Because, I'm sorry, where are the checks and balances between the rich and the poor? I mean, those are the ones we care about. Where are the checks and balances between the power of corporations and, say, living rivers? And then I want to read a couple more things and then shut up for a second.
You know, I have a copy of The Great Law of Peace from the Haudenosaunee Society, mm-hmm. up there, the whole deal. And it's right next to the Constitution. So it's really interesting because they said that, you know, we took a lot of our Constitution from what the great law of the Iroquois Confederacy, which theoretically had six nations or seven nations that had worked together for thousands of years and had managed to figure out ways to conduct themselves and govern themselves in a peaceful way. So I've got a copy that's got the Great Law of Peace here, and it's got the Constitution here. And so I looked at what the idea of checks and balances were from the Great Law of Peace, and what it was is the women chose a man to be a chief executive, which is what I think is a really good role for men, that they be chosen to be the executive. The women say, we need a safe place to live, and we need a place for our kids to be safe and the men safe. You got it. That's what I want to see. That's what I'd like to see. So if the man screwed up, then the women gave him two more times. Three is always the magic number, although with Native people it's mostly fours that are spiritual, whatever. So they gave him two more times, and if it goofed, then he was replaced. They got another chief executive that was going to support what the people needed to be done. And the women were also the judges. So these were the checks and balances that were more originally done from those Native peoples, which the United States government obviously did not copy that part. Because I think we as women got the vote in 1920. We had nothing to say about designing the damn thing. I said, why do I want the vote for what some rich white boys decided in 1776? This is not my government. I much prefer a government that's parliamentarian or something where if we want to vote green and there's 6% of our votes green, we get 6% of the seats or something. I would love something that was representational. I would love to be a good citizen in a really democratic culture, that we were really working with each other, for each other, and considering what else is going on. It's really, really frustrating to want to serve and to want to have a place where your kids are safe and where animals are safe and where Earth is safe and where we're living in such a way, like permaculture, or like ideally we would use energy, like the wind. You know, it passes through, we use it, and it goes, keeps going, and it's not polluted, it's not messed up, it's not wasted, it's just a way of living that's a sustainable way of living. I would love to do that, and I would pay taxes if I needed to pay money to groups of people who are willing to do that. As it is, I refuse to pay taxes, and I won't support war, and I've been doing that all my life. I paid $647 in my life so far for Social Security. And I will never get Social Security because I haven't worked enough cash time in my life to be able to get Social Security. But $647 towards, that's not bad. That's not bad. So it is, there's, some of this stuff is possible, and it's certainly something to think about and reflect on. Now, you were going to take a minute off, right? Isn't that where we went? You were reading something, then you were going to take a minute? I'm sorry.
No, that's great. I want to check in. So how are you doing with the format so far? Is this okay? Okay.
What is the name of that book that you were quoting from?
Oh, this one, which I haven't quoted from yet, but I'm going to.
You quoted?
No, I wrote that.
You wrote that?
Well, no, so surprised.
I thought it was from the book, and I was saying, that's really good, Derek. No, I want to read that book.
No, I wrote that yesterday.
Not bad, right?
The Rising of the Moon by Flynn Connolly. And Stephanie McMillan, my friend, introduced me to this book, and she said that she, and the politics are great all through this book, and she said that she contacted the author several years ago, and the author never wrote another book because it was received so poorly. Anyway, there's a couple quotes in here that I want to do from some Irish or American resistance people that I just loved. Henry David Thoreau said, all men, and by that I hope he meant people, recognize the right to revolution, that is, the right to refuse allegiance to and to resist the government when its tyranny or its inefficiency are great and unendurable. That's a good one. 106. James Connolly. The soul of Ireland preached revolution, declared that no bloodletting could be as disastrous as a cowardly acceptance of the rule of the conqueror, nay, that the rule of the conqueror would necessarily entail more bloodletting than revolt against the rule. It's like we hear all the time, one of the things I talk about in my regular endgame talk is premise four, which is one of my favorite premises of that book, which is that this culture has a rigidly defined yet often unarticulated hierarchy. And violence done by those higher on the hierarchy to those lower is invisible. It's unnoticed. And violence done by those lower on the hierarchy to those higher is unthinkable. And when it does happen, it's met with shock, horror, and the fetishization of the victims. And there's just a bazillion examples of this. One example is my own family, that my father was extremely violent. My brother has epilepsy from blows to the head. He broke my sister's arm. He raped my mother, my sister, and me. And the one time my brother fought back, he was beaten far worse than any other time because he committed blasphemy by sending violence up the hierarchy. That's one example. Another example would be bears. there's bazillions of bears where I live. I see them almost every day. And my mom has a great relationship with the bears. The mother bears bring their babies up to her, and she has great relationship. Except this year, one of the babies learned how to ring my mom's doorbell, which was really fun for about the first 6 hours.
Yeah, exactly.
And after that, it's like she now hates that baby. She doesn't really, but it's like learn a different trick or something. And one day, a bear was. My mom woke up, and a bear was standing outside her door, mooning her. Anyway, the point is that I walk through the forest, and be like, "Oh my God, Derek, you walk through the forest. Aren't you afraid that bears are going to kill you? You know, there's bears and bears and bears. Oh my!" And the thing is, what I know is that there's one person dies in North America every 2 years from a bear attack, and on the other hand, there's 46,000 people die every year in the United States from automobile accidents. So the truth is that we should like walk through a forest without a worry in the world, and then you walk through a fucking parking lot. It's like, another example, cops. Every day in the United States, between 4 and 6 people die because they encountered police. That's through beatings, shootings, high-speed chases, and medical neglect in prisons and jails. Every time a cop dies, a big state funeral, you know, bumper stickers, some gave all gave some. But on the other hand, the most dangerous civil service profession is garbage collection. Way, way more dangerous because you're hanging out with these big fucking trucks that want to kill you. And when was the last time you saw a state funeral for a garbage collector? You know, when was the last time you saw a Tom Cruise movie where he's this intrepid garbage man that's cleaning up the mean streets of L.A.? It doesn't happen because it doesn't valorize the violence that flows down the hierarchy. And if you don't believe me on this whole cop thing, you know, try this whole thought experiment, which is, the next time you go to some anti-war rally or some anti-globalization protest, take a baseball bat. And I walk up to a cop and say, it's a thought experiment, and say, excuse me, officer friendly, nothing personal, but I'm doing an experiment. And then hit him a couple more times real fast. And then I'll talk to him about 50 years. Another example of this is there was in Oklahoma, a woman was beaten to death by her husband, and he was sentenced to 7 years in prison. And then during the judicial process, he spat on a cop. And for that, he was sentenced to life in prison. I don't understand what people are complaining about. I mean, that's the natural order, is it not? Man, woman, cop. This is the... I guess they have not been socialized enough. A few more years of school, and you'll get it. I wasn't serious. See, that's an example. Oh, another example. And I feel a little bit weird saying this close to New York City, but 9/11. You know? Okay, I've started. I'm going to go ahead. There were about 3,000 people. I mean, I got to tell you, at least we in the West, I mean, frankly, we're really sick of hearing about 9/11. And we're the only people who are sick of hearing about 9/11. Okay, there's two of us. We can form a support group. Last time a politician did not mention 9/11 was 9/10. And... there were 3,000 people died that day. There are 15,000 Americans die every 2 weeks from preventable cancers. There are 500,000 children die every year as a direct result of so-called debt repayment from non-industrialized nations to industrialized nations. I just learned this a couple days ago. There are 120,000 people die in the world every single day from the effects of pollution, directly from the effects of pollution. 120,000 every day. That's 49/11s. But those aren't violence. You know, it's only violence when it flows up the hierarchy. There's just so many examples. This is just all through. I mean, Jaws, you know? I live 3 miles from the ocean. I never stick my foot in the ocean. The reason? Because I fuck a movie Jaws. And
I was in Florida with my kids when that movie came, and every time I try to go in the water, my kids were like, Mama, don't go! It was horrible.
Exactly. And the ratio of human attacks on sharks to shark attacks on humans is 20 million to one. I mean, so the shark's like swimming through the water, and they see some feet up there. It's like they start hearing that fucking music, you know? So one of the things that we've been deeply inculcated into believing is that it's okay for violence to flow down the hierarchy and not up. And mind if I take like another 10 minutes to do a little digression here? Okay.
Thanks for asking.
Does anybody mind if I swear?
No.
Okay. Because I think the most amazing word in the English language is the word fuck. Because it's all of patriarchy condensed to four letters. Because the same word that means make love to means do great violence to, which is really, really
fucked.
It's also really confusing because somebody can say to me, I'm going to fuck you. I need more information. And so first, this is all of patriarchy condensed to four letters. This conflation of sex and violence, which is really disturbing and really, really messed up. And it also pervades this culture. And it also is... it also helped me understand homophobia, frankly, because I never understood homophobia before, because I always thought that if you don't like homosexuals, you probably just didn't date one. And then I finally understood it because of this conflation of sex and violence can only flow down, means that sex can only flow down. And another way to put this is that Catherine McKinnon has this... Oh, that chicken, whoever cooked that chicken is just as good the second time around. Catherine McKinnon has this great line, man fucks woman, subject, verb, object. Man fucks woman, subject, verb, object. And to show how deep the objectification of women is within this culture, even within the context of a loving heterosexual relationship, it's really difficult to not grammatically objectify the woman. So the man can say to the woman, I would like to be inside of you. She's the object of the sentence. So the woman then says to the man, I would like for you to be inside me. She's still the object of the sentence. So the man's going to be all groovy and feminist, and so he says, I would like for you to be around me. And she's like, you know, the body is willing and the spirit has no idea what you're talking about. Speak English, please. And the way this ties back to the homophobia thing is I was a while ago listening to NPR. I'm so sorry. I only did it once, and I was in the car, and I was forced to. I've never done it again. Anyway, I was listening to NPR, and at least it wasn't All Things Considered. And small things. That's great. Uh-huh. I always call it Corporate Things Considered, but I like Small Things Considered better. I was actually listening to Small Things Considered one time, and this is 20 years ago. This is like the last time I ever took it seriously. It just pissed me off so much, and it had to do with this region. It was when George Bush the first was saying that the people who did not want taxes lowered on the rich, he was saying that the reason they didn't want that to happen is because they were like Puritans who did not want anybody else to be happy either. That if they're not having fun, they don't want anybody else to have fun. And that was his response. And so the response by Noah Adams or whatever the hell his name is on Small Things Considered was they said that sentence. And they said, now, to really discuss this, we're going to ask someone, did the Puritans really not have fun? That was their fucking political analysis. Anyway, I don't know why I'm staring at you when I say that. It's not your fault.
I don't know either. I'm just taking a drink.
Anyway, I was listening to NPR, and this military spokesman said, he's a man. It was important he's a man, actually. Spokesperson, whatever.
Thank you.
She's really big. Actually, when I finish this, why don't you talk about gender specificity?
Okay.
And maybe we can even disagree. That might be fun. We haven't disagreed yet, really.
Not really.
Okay. We'll try.
Okay.
Okay. Anyway, so the spokesperson is saying that the reason that homosexuals should not be allowed in the military is because, well, actually, I need to say before I go any further that I agree that homosexuals should not be allowed in the military. I feel that so strongly, that homosexuals should not be allowed in the U.S. military. But then again, I think that heterosexuals and transsexuals and bisexuals and asexuals should not be allowed in the U.S. military either. Unless each one had their own army. You know, it's like the bisexual brigade to the rescue or something. Anyway, so this military spokesperson is saying, can you imagine what would happen if a private, a heterosexual lieutenant? I was thinking, yeah, sure, I can imagine that, but that wasn't his point. He was saying it would destroy chain of command. And not because the lieutenant would fall in love with a private and not be able to order the private to his death, but instead, notice he said if a private has sex with a lieutenant. He did not say if a lieutenant has sex with a private. Because within a patriarchy where sex and violence are conflated, and violence can only flow down, that means sex can only flow down, and man has to fuck woman, subject, verb, object, what that means is that you have to have a fucker and a fucky. And the fucky has to be lower on the hierarchy than the fucker. And if the fucker, and this is where homophobia comes in, because if the fucker and the fucky are on the same level, then all the little tiny brains just seize up. It destroys the whole hierarchy.
Well, and one of the men has to play the part of woman.
Yes.
That's a big
absolutely
deal.
Absolutely. I'll do more quotes in a minute, but I want to hear about gender specificity and why that's bad.
I am a person that believes in gender-inclusive language. I have been this way for probably 25 years. I remember a letter that I wrote to Noam Chomsky, and Noam Chomsky at that time responded to letters. Not like Derek does not, because I wrote him a letter too. But anyway, Dewey didn't write back to me.
Maybe I didn't get it. No, seriously, I do. I spend 4 fucking hours a night answering fucking emails.
Not emails.
Oh, regular letters.
Regular letters. I don't use email. Anyway, so I sent a letter, because Noam Chomsky is also a linguist, okay? So he writes this book, and I forget which one it was, 25 years ago. And at the beginning he says, we're going to use the male pronoun in this book for convenience. So my question is, whose convenience is that? It's not mine, because as probably there's as many women that read Noam Chomsky stuff as men. And so whenever they put man, he, him, mankind, whatever, I got to go through this thing in my head and change it around and say, well, is he talking about a particular man? Is he pretending that this term means all of human beings? So I wrote him a letter. And I told him, I said, you're a linguist, you know, the importance of language, you know, and then at the bottom I would always put, I hope to see your increased consciousness reflected in your next work. Just to let them know I'm watching. See what they're going to do. So he sent me a letter. He said the point was well taken and suggested that I read a couple of books about, you know, feminism and linguistics. And I thought, I don't need this book. Obviously, you know, someone else may need this book. But so by using gender-inclusive language, the exciting thing about that and the thing that I love the most about it is, first of all, I can get people to stop saying you guys. And so I suggest that they say y'all. It's one thing you can say. And since I'm now from North Carolina, I can say that. You can also say you guyans or you guyas. If you're into earth-based stuff like that. You can say folks. You can say, you don't have to man a booth. You can staff it. You can do, I mean, I can go through the paper every day and find all these places where they don't use gender-inclusive language. And I think it's unfortunate because our language so determines, just like you're talking about, this subject-object-verb type of thing, your language so determines the way you perceive reality. When I think about a Hopi language that doesn't have a future or a past tense, and I try to imagine even remotely thinking without a future or a past tense.
Some types of mushrooms have 25,000 genders.
I like that.
I just read that. I have no idea what that means. I mean, it changes how you think about sex.
Yeah, well, I would, especially in mushrooms.
Yeah. Anyway, sorry. Go ahead.
What is that?
It's 28,000 genders. It's not only multiple nucleus, but multiple chromosomes inside the nucleuses. It gives you like 99.98% outbreeding ability, and within its own species, only a within its own family unit, less inbreeding. So it promotes outbreeding.
I like that.
Yeah.
Okay, so. Thank you. And what book was it that you saw that at? Do you remember?
Oh, I saw it in just a. It was a. I was reading about Amanitas.
Okay.
And then there was a reference to how many genders there, and then that reference, but that's nothing compared to the. Whatever one he said, that has 28,000.
Yeah, if you look up schizophyllum commune, there's a website by Rod Tullis out in Michigan where he really discusses gender and mushrooms and takes a few reads to understand.
All right, here we go. So anyway, so it's an interesting thing, and even though so many women don't want to give up their thing of saying you guys, because I get a lot of resistance from women about this, And I've tried to find out why that is. I mean, just like when I was younger, I used to say, oh man, you know, like, because that was a hip thing to say in the 60s or 50s or whenever I was around that. But, and I think that you guys is like part of being hip now for women or men. And it just is just very interesting when you begin to look at language and begin to say, okay, how much, like I always say, like verbs. Bucky Fuller always said, life and life is a verb. Okay, so when people talk about a creator as a noun, I can't relate. You say creating as a verb, and I can relate. So I can talk about creating and see that as a constant process, an ongoing evolutionary expansion thing. But when you make that into a noun, I don't relate to it, you know? So there's just so much in language, and I'm glad you brought that up. Oh, yeah.
I want to say a couple things and then do a quick audience participation thing. Which is, one of them is, and I this may be more detailed than people want, and I can't actually believe I'm going to say something about my sexual history, because I usually hold that, I'm very private about that. But I had a lover once that if we were making love, and I said something like, oh my God, she would always say, des.
Des.
Yeah. Like, oh my God.
All right, okay. Excellent.
Yeah, so it was like, oh my God, goddess. Anyway, so what I would like to do for a quick audience participation thing is there are some words that I really that I don't like a lot that, I mean, it's like the guys thing. Mm-hmm. Like, I use the word resources, but I hate the word because trees aren't resources. Trees are trees. And how you perceive the world affects how you behave in the world. And there's a great line by Canadian Lumber, when I look at trees, I see dollar bills, which is resourcification. If when you look at trees, you see dollar bills, you're going to treat them one way. If when you look at trees, you trees, you'll treat them another way. If when you look at this particular tree, you see this particular tree, you'll treat it a different way. Same with fish. That's one of the horrible, horrible, horrible things about pornography. If when I look at women, I see orifices, I'm going to treat them one way. If when I look at women, I see women, I'll treat them another way, and so on and so on. And so resource is a word I hate. I don't like the word brutal as applied to an act of violence. Or like there was a rapist. Oh, he's a real animal. It was a real brutal rape. Because that implies that those are animal, they're animal hating. They're human supremacist. And so I feel pretty strongly about those. We can go through, I don't say we for the government. Like a friend calls up and says, how much longer do you think our government's going to be in Iraq? It's like, or no, they say, how much longer do you think we're going to be in Iraq? I was going to say, how much longer do you think we're going to be in Iraq? It's like, oh, they're in Connecticut. It's like, okay, how much longer do you think our troops are going to be in Iraq? Like, I got troops? Holy shit, will they do what I tell them? Yeah, and then they hang up on me. So those are a couple, and I could go through a whole long list, and there's the gender specificity. I mean, I try to be very careful about that. So what I would like to do is just go around quickly and have people say if there are words like the you guys, words or phrases mm-hmm. like you guys, or the oh my God, or you know, obviously I don't like fuck as I use it all the time as an adjective, which some people don't like, but I don't use it for the sexual act. I mean, if somebody were to say, mm-hmm. if I'm really going to say, I would like to fuck you, I'd be like, no thanks.
Yeah.
You know, I think I'll pass. Thank you very much. But I would like to talk about Jane Caputi's work. You know, let's talk about some feminism. So I would like to go around, and just, you don't have to say if you don't want, but like if there are words that are in common usage that you particularly find offensive, and it doesn't mean that other people have to do them. I mean, I don't care. I'm not going to get mad at you if you use the word resource. I mean, hell, I use the word resource. If I took every book off a bookshelf that used a word I don't like, My books wouldn't be on my bookshelves. I got a note from somebody the other day, and I hope this doesn't offend you. I got a note from somebody the other day saying that she was reading my book, Songs of the Dead, and she thought it was really good. It's a great feminist book, I think. I intentionally made that book. It's like nonfiction Jane Caputi. I mean, I'm sorry, fiction Jane Caputi. And she said, I put the book down because you used the word panties. And this is like sort of higher level. I don't know what, and I was talking to three feminist friends of mine. Two of them are like, whatever. It's like, I use the word, whatever. But one feminist friend said, I don't use the word panties myself because there's no male cutesy equivalent. And that's sort of sexualizing women's underwear. You don't hear boxies. And there's some sort of cutesy. And so, I know, that's manly.
Yes.
Manly, yes, but I like it too.
Tidy whiteys.
Yeah. Tidy whiteys. Ah, I'll tell my friend tidy whiteys. Okay, so the point is we can get I think kind of esoteric with this in terms of it can English is a language based on patriarchy. It's a patriarchal language of commerce. And so if I went around never saying the word resources, it's like what I would have to say is there are a lot of trees that people perceive as resources. And so recognizing the whole language is patriarchal and recognizing, you can say a word that you don't like, that doesn't mean that necessarily either one of us is not going to use it the rest of the night. So just go around, if there's like words you especially don't like for political reasons of some sort, go ahead and say them. And, we'll go really fast, otherwise we'll be here for the rest of the night just on this. And we'll, skip people if they don't say something. And we can come back to you.
Jungle fever?
That's pretty bad.
Well, it's not political, but the word bored in general, just the word bored. Motherfucker, but I don't mean that in as horizontal hostility against, authers I like.
Like me, thank you very much. I got problems with it too, but I use it all the fucking time.
The word slut?
Oh, yeah.
Socialism, when people use it as sort of a derogatory term. Like, that guy's a socialist.
Harassment? Or ass?
The sound duh that people make?
That's the one I do.
Okay. We can talk about it.
Yeah. We'll discuss it later.
Okay. Retarded? I think the word rape is used way too often for things that don't need to be, for sentences it doesn't need to be used in.
It's not rape.
Like, for example, I've heard this before, somebody raped a pet.
I raped you in this video game. It's not exactly funny.
Yeah. That's pretty nasty. Jeez.
Or get raped.
Yeah.
Not meaning rape at all.
Right.
But it's diminishing it so much that it's, unimportant and it's such a...
I think about that a lot. I obviously would never use it the way you're saying there. But then, do we get to call this... Like, there's a book, I don't remember her name, but there's a book called The Rape of the Wild. And can we talk about, is what this dominant culture is doing to the oceans, is that, I think one can make a really reasoned argument that is related to rape, that those come from the same sort of imperatives. I'm not disagreeing with you.
I think that, for me personally, I think it has to do with social awareness. I think you have to be aware of what you're saying when you're saying it. And in context, if you use the word rape, to describe something that is, in fact, like what you're saying with the oceans, I would say we are raping the oceans.
Or they are.
Definitely, but people are so uneducated nowadays that even just in a social setting, people will use terms regardless of their actual meaning.
Right.
They're not saying, I'm going to rape you in this video game to mean what I'm talking
about.
Yeah,
that really makes me want to hang out and play this video game with you.
Right, but it's just misinterpreting the meaning of a word and really belittling it, like you just said. So that when we do speak of it in a serious context, people kind of forget that meaning.
Right.
References to civilized and uncivilized behavior.
Yeah.
People saying that's gay.
Mm-hmm.
It's noticing it in the younger generation of kids, but still, that's really awful to hear it saying, meaning that's lame.
Right.
Bad.
Right. When I was in high school and college, my friends and I would call each other fags all the time.
Yeah, that was another word I was thinking.
And well, yeah. And did I ever tell you? Did I write about how I quit doing that? Is that I had a friend who was bisexual, and one time I was teaching him how to drive, and he ran my car into a post, and I said, "Oh, you fag," and he said, Yeah, and what does that have to do with me running your car into a post? And I didn't use it again. I mean, I got it. You know, I understood that fag is not a generic. Wow. But it had to be taught.
Yeah.
I can think of a whole slew of sexual-related words that are particularly awful to hear. Like, even words that are, you know, people are trying to reclaim, like, cunt and bitch and, like, all these things that, like, make my skin crawl a little bit.
Goddamn.
Is there a reason? Is it because it's Christian or because you're Christian or both or neither?
It's kind of like you're... When you're saying it, you're kind of like evoking God to like damn this thing. It's kind of like you're just mad.
I guess it's not a very commonly used as an offensive term, but personally, I see nothing wrong with the animal. But people kind of use it in a demeaning way.
Oh, yeah.
Independent. I don't like when you know people say they're an independent when they're really just a corrupt politician.
Wait, are you talking to anyone in specific?
Anybody who fits that bill. Yeah.
I think someone else was saying it earlier, but civilization, as in like acting like what we're living in now is actually civilized and like humane, I guess, in that sense. So like the current sort of organizational structure of our society, like that, like we actually
are very civilized, and that's a bad thing.
Yeah, but if whenever I think of civilization, I think of like a sort of harmonious society that's not like destroying itself or destroying. It's inhabitants, so I don't think of civilization. I don't think that we've achieved what my idea of civilization is. We're like half the world's population is in poverty.
Right. I hear you, and I can. I'm not disagreeing with you. That's your experience. My definition of civilization, my experience of it, is this actually is civilization. There's a great line by Stanley Diamond: "Civilization originates in conquest abroad and repression at home." But that's a whole other topic.
The word like is often used, you know, he totally said this and then like I said this, you know, and I use it too sometimes. And it came to my attention really when I was in Italy, because whenever they pause, when they're thinking, instead of using or like, they say allora, allora. And it's just like this beautiful word. See, I just did it. It's just this beautiful word that they use to pause, and like and get so lit in our conversations.
I knew this guy from Ireland who. I knew this guy from Ireland that instead of saying he said im. And I kept thinking he was saying him. So he would say, "Well, I'm thinking about im." And I would say, "Who?"
I say the word safety. I feel like we use the word safety like all the time. Dude. When I want to force you to do something, it's for your own safety. Right. So I feel like that word is misused on a constant basis in order to force other people to do you want to put them into a little box.
For your convenience and safety, we're going to imprison you.
To be honest with you, or trust me. Come on.
My parents get really kind of annoyed when I say whatever at the end of something, or if I say, oh, it's whatever. I don't really understand why, but they just get really, really annoyed. So.
People tend to preface things with, I'm not going to lie, but I totally love that, which seems to imply that you're just going to be dishonest. Which I think you should just imply that you're always going to be honest.
Yeah. Or I was going to say, then just say it.
I was just going to say euphemisms for people killing other people, like, you know, collateral damage or like, well, really anything, frankly, using any words other than like homicide for it.
about killing.
I don't really like the word, like, how it's sometimes used natural or all natural.
Yeah.
Because it's just like, it's natural, it can't be bad for you. It's like, yeah, it's natural arsenic. It's kind of like creating this disconnect between something that's safe and something that's natural.
Right.
I'd steal a page from Carol Adams and anything that references meat or the meat consumption, like saying guy who looks good is a beefcake or something. That girl who looks cute has, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. And also, I try to speak of my food, whether it's animal or vegetable or fungus, as food.
Yeah.
It's like nobody ever asks me to say grace at Thanksgiving anymore, because they got tired of me thanking the turkey and the potatoes. And I would also like to thank the American Indians whose land we're now living on was stolen. And I would like to thank, it's like, I just want to eat some fucking potatoes, you know? Anyway, yeah, so it's very much, that's it's great.
Well, one thing is when products are described as organic, which implies that an apple can be not alive at some point. But seriously, every apple was organic at some point because it was alive, technically speaking. But then they specify it's organic or otherwise.
Right.
Green bothers me. We're green, environmentally you still exploited the earth.
Words that end in "-ist," like communist, anarchist, environmentalist, as if you can't dialogue with anyone else about anything. And often when people throw those labels, it's like they're putting you in their preformed vision of what that means.
Right. Yeah, lately I've been kicked out of the anarchy club. I wasn't a good enough anarchist, I guess, which I didn't know was possible.
The word educated.
Educated.
Just sort of implying when a lot of people say, "Oh, well, they're so educated," kind of implies that those that do go to school or have certain types of, learning or skill level or something are just so educated. It's very sort of elitist, hierarchical statement, I feel like, a lot of times when it's used.
Speaking of elitist assholes,
plenty of them here.
Yeah. Sam Harris is, goddamn, oops, sorry. Sam Harris, who makes me angry. One of the things he wrote is he was talking about how he was attacking Christianity, which is a fine and righteous thing to do. But he was saying that any Christian of the 14th century would be, if you resurrected the person would be a, quote, total ignoramus compared to people today. And that science is really progressive as opposed to religion as the maintenance of dogma. And there's just so much bigotry in that statement. But it's like, Sam, I would like you to meet Dante Alighieri. I would like you to meet William of Ockham. How about Catherine of Siena? And then there's the whole question of what is educated, which is why I brought this up, is that, he lists astronomy, medicine, and all these other ways people today would be much, and geography, as ways people would be much more educated, much more informed. And it's like, okay, how many people tonight can name when the next new moon is?
Where's our specialist?
Exactly. It's like every 14th century, I'm guessing that 90% of the people in the 14th century would have known when the next new moon is. And I'm guessing most every indigenous child prior to the arrival of this culture would have known when the next new moon is. Could you, where is the nearest, name 10 species of edible plants and fungi within 100 yards of this place. I mean, how's that? Yeah. He's the one that's going to save us all. It's just what we are informed about is even about technology. You know what I know about computers? You push the little silver button, and the thing turns on. And then if it stops going, that's the technical term, then what I have to do is I pick up this piece of plastic and I dial these numbers. How the fuck's the phone work? I don't know. And I ask my friend Eric, my computer's dead. What do I do now? That's what I know about technology. It's like, I don't know how the fuck it works. Are you kidding me? It's like little men run around inside and they do all the calculations real fast. Well, women. Probably women, actually, because they're fucking slaves, you know? All these little women run around inside doing calculations. That's how the computer works. Yeah, our ignorance is just...
That's my
problem. Down.
And it's really
attractive too. It's like, hey, you want to touch my junk? You're like, no thanks, go ahead and put it in the wastebasket where it belongs, you know? Put it in the trash disposal. That's a phrase people use?
Oh yeah.
I typically hear it from male body.
They say, this is my junk.
So women can do it too.
Gender
so
neutral.
I'm glad we've got gender neutrality.
Wow. Okay.
So are you happy now?
We've got universal junk.
Seriously, this makes me feel old and out of touch.
It's okay. There's other things to have in touch when you're old.
Yeah, I don't want to be out of touch with my junk. Okay, seriously, how many people have used that word about your own junk? Wow.
But it really bothers me the elevation of our pet peeves about language and even our probably righteous crusades for gender neutrality in our speech, to elevate that to the level of ecosystem collapse in our discourse, our political lives, our activist lives. That bothers me.
I think he's saying we should change topic.
Oh, no, not at all.
Okay, I think it's not an either or. And I think that, okay, I hear you. I've gotten 1,008, I think it is, pieces of hate mail in the last 9 years, two of which were from right-wing people. The other 1,006 were from people complaining because of my casual use of the word fuck. Or vegetarians complaining because they don't eat meat, because I eat meat. Or car drivers complaining anti-car activists because I drive a car. Or because I use the word panties. And there is this idea of there's a wretched cliche, but not seeing the forest for the trees. You know, it's like, and okay, 120 species, or however many I said, went extinct today. I mean, there's 10 times as much plastic as there is phytoplankton in many parts of the ocean. And I'm sorry, we're talking about words? Are you fucking out of your mind? What we need to do is we need to strap on and lay waste to all those motherfuckers, you know? And that is a fine and righteous impulse, which I do not disagree with in the slightest. That said, it's like, I agree and, you know? Because there is this desperate urgency. And I was at a Deep Green Resistance workshop that I ran with Eric and Lierre in Bellingham, Washington. And many of the exercises were about militant resistance. And if you want to ask about militant resistance, when we get done with this little exercise, ask it and I will be ready to just run with it, okay? I am delighted to talk about militant resistance. Or if you don't, that's fine too, I don't care. But the point is that having to do with all this is that, once again, I agree with you that that there is a point at which things do become semantic. It's like, Jesus fucking Christ, let's get on with the revolution, you know? And then there's also, back to the DGR workshop, is many of the exercises were about militant resistance, and we also did things like some people were envisioning, you know, the militant sort of people was like, we did an A to B thing. How do we get from here, where we are in this psychopathic culture, to living sustainably? And different people broke into different groups according to what they were interested in, whether it was the militant people, it's like, okay, how do we form paramilitary organizations? What do we do? What are the steps that resistance groups go through? How do you have a security culture? How do you form a paramilitary organization within a fucking panopticon? Okay? People are talking about how do we get from a non-rape culture, from a rape culture to a non-rape culture. You know, I love Andrea Dworkin's line, my prayer for women of the 21st century is harden your hearts and learn to kill. You know, that's part of how we get there. Another part of how we get there is as men, standing in alliance with women, absolutely. And saying rape is not acceptable. And we males and we females are going to stop it. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's all really important. That's all crucial. The point is that there was this one group that was talking about like what communities look like and you know what a democratic community looks like versus a non-democratic. They're talking about all this stuff. Okay, and they write down all these characteristics of how they're going to get to a democratic, sustainable community. And there was this good friend of mine in the audience. Her name's Waz. She's a Dakota woman. She's a Dakota Indian activist and writer. She's great. She's militant. She wears a shirt sometimes that says, fuck patience. I just love it. And, okay, because so many of her people are like, we need to be patient with the white people. And it's like, we've been fucking patient for 500 years. No, the time for patience is way over. Okay, anyway, so she's great. Anyway, so she's seeing all these things that the people are writing up on the board about what a sustainable community is like, and she says, you know, there's something missing here, which is I don't see any acknowledgement that you're living on stolen land. And before you can have a sustainable community, you have to recognize that this is our land. This is not your land. And we need to start from that perspective. And that was all, and she said that, and she said it very nicely, and then some people responded very well, and some people got very defensive. The point is that at one point, the guy who had actually organized the thing turned around to her, and he said, you know, the world's being killed. I can't deal with this mental masturbation of whose land is it, because right now the salmon are being killed. And that led to a really interesting conversation, because it is Dakota land. You know? Whose land is this right here?
States.
Whose land is this?
Mohegan,
Pequot. I believe it's the Nipmo.
Isn't it Nipmo?
Yeah.
Okay, so the point is that I think it is absolutely crucial for us to attend to whose land this is. At the same time, we need to not get lost in the urgency, we need to not lose the urgency of the fact that 120 species went extinct today, and the corporate culture is killing the planet. And I think that, remember, Maud Gunn was part of the English Gaelic revival, and she recognized the importance of reviving the Gaelic language for Irish resistance at the same time that she was smuggling stuff into prisons. You see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. It's like, I think that this little exercise is actually really important. At the same time, and fun, at the same time, I think that I want to thank you, not forgive you, I want to thank you for also returning us to the urgency. Do you see what I'm saying? That I think we desperately need it all, including attention to language, including... I just learned this yesterday that there is, I'm not going to say who it is, but there is, and this is pretty disgusting, it's disgusting the fact that I even know this, there is a sort of environmental leader, male, who is proud of the fact that when he, I think fucks would be the term, a woman, that he likes to call her bitch and have her call him daddy. That's pretty problematical. And at the same, I mean, so... But we can hold in our hearts the understanding that that's really fucked up at the same time that there's this other going on. Does that make sense? I'm trying to welcome and honor your sense of urgency, which you know from my work that I desperately share, at the same time that I honor the fact that it can be insulting for someone to call a woman's genitals pussy. I think that though we can hold both of those. Okay, and actually I'm gonna get another example I think that is really, really important, which is two of Ward Churchill's ex-wives have accused him of being a batterer. And I think it's pretty safe to say that Ward Churchill is an abuser. And right now there's a woman I know who's a great activist who doesn't want to be in a film because Ward Churchill is also in that film, and she doesn't want to be in a film with a batterer. And that's very true, and I respect that. At the same time, how many people are calling for the militant resistance against this culture and for us to bring down civilization? Well, there's me, and there's Ward, and there's me, and Ward. And it's like, well, throw one of them out the fucking window. It's like, what do you do? I mean, and this segues to something else that I mentioned to you in passing, but I do want to mention. I mentioned I was proud of my response to that woman at that one talk. Mm-hmm. I want to say what this was. I did a talk up in Vancouver, and I had done a talk there 6 months previously, and so they're not going to have me do the same endgame talk again. And so we go straight to Q&A. And unfortunately, I did not share the stage with you that night. That would have been delightful. It was just me. And the first question was, a woman stood up and said, I want to talk about hypocrisy in the environmental movement. And I'm thinking, oh, shit, here we go. You know, she's going to say, you flew up here, which means I don't listen to anything you say. It's just blah, blah. I've gotten that fucking lifestyle. I mean, I'm not putting you in that category at all, because that's absolutely different what you're saying. You know, take time off so that you can actually do good work. Mm-hmm. As opposed to take time off so you can feel pure and then... Oh, wait, that's gender specific. So yeah. You can...
Yeah, I understand.
Okay, so anyway, so this woman stood up and said, I want to talk about the environmental movement. She did not go the direction I thought. Instead, she said, I was raped by someone you know, and the environmental community is a rape community, and I want to talk about that. And I said, okay, first, who? And she said his name, David Barbaresh, and he's an environmental animal rights activist from BC. And I said, okay, first off, I don't actually know him. I interviewed him once. I don't know him. I got to tell you that. Not a friend of mine. Second, I believe you. Third, he was supposed to be in a book of interviews that I have coming out in a couple months, How Should I Live My Life? I'm taking him out of the book because I do not want a rapist in my book. And fourth, I would like to ask you what you as a woman, what you as a woman in this culture want from a man when you tell him that you have been raped. What do you want from me as someone sitting here on stage? What do you want from your boyfriend? What do you want from your father? What do you want from your best friend? What do you want from fellow activists? And it was wonderful because so many women then talked about, this is what I want. This is what I got, and this is what I did not get. And there were other women actually in the audience who had also been sexually assaulted by the same guy. Why did I bring all that up? Because sometimes I get pegged as the violence guy because I wanted to talk about fighting back, but I'm really the everything guy. And I really believe, I'm a writer for crying out loud, I believe in the importance of language and the importance of attempting to be precise and attempting to, words are sacred to me and words are living beings to me. And I gotta get rid of the habit of saying fucking about everything. But that doesn't take away from the other. That's all.
Could I pay you a minor flattery then?
All the time.
I find you particularly appropriate for this, and so I'm trying to, if I may, guide things just a little, give you a hint, because I think you're particularly well suited to this. I don't want to throw everyone out of the boat whose A concern doesn't get over mine. I'm not trying to trump everyone or amp it up to the, like, fuck it, like, none of this matters except for the guns and the machetes thing. It's just that I know some of these folks personally, actually, and now 100 people are like, fuck you, dude, I don't know you. But there is, and oh God, defy me, there's a frightening sort of anti-intellectualism in our community that likes to deny the sort of, there's a fancy word for thinking that there's no such thing as reality. I can't remember what it is. But
postmodern fucking bullshit.
But not only are you a good integrator of many things and bring many people in with your personal issues and your great open-armedness, and here's the flattery, to all sorts of stuff people I don't want to throw out of the boat, but what you could maybe speak to better than me, because I have a criminal record, they're not going to put me in front of a class talking about biology, is you throw away the word sustainable, a couple other, like, what are strictly ecological terms, in normal language that many of us are half familiar with, and there's a reluctance to accept sort of the basic truth of science, not the sort of shady, like, this is a theory kind of stuff, but the belief that our political, our intense political beliefs are somehow not subject to anything, because we can have any opinion we want, we can create our lives or whatever. And so I hear a talk that waves in and out of the deeply personal or the deeply political, and we throw in these environmental metaphors, and there's none of the weight of the fact that, like, you need so many calories and so many kilograms of water. There's none of the weight, because we have had that eroded away. And I would, maybe particularly you, could bring some of that back to people whose political convictions and personal convictions have been, I think, to their detriment, cut loose from how much that matters.
Wait, you have just described the entire fucking culture. You know, I mean, no, that's not a bad thing. I mean, what do all of the so-called solutions to global warming have in common? What they all have in common is they take industrial capitalism as a given. And the natural world, the real physical world, is that which must conform to industrial capitalism. It's insane, literally, in terms of being out of touch with physical reality. Do you mind if I just keep going? Because I want to rip on this for a minute, if that's fine with you. I mean, I don't wanna...
Go riff it.
Okay. Well, I want to be attentive to the fact that I'm a male and you're a female. I've been talking more than you have.
I know. You were advertised here more than I was. Maybe next time that won't be true.
Okay.
But this time.
Okay. So I was doing this radio interview in Santa Barbara, and I was talking about how 90% of the large fish in the oceans are gone, and how salmon are getting hammered, and there's docks in every mother's breast milk, and you know, just all the things that I talk about all the time. And the radio interviewer kept saying the same thing, which is, that's all nice, Derek, but let's get back in the real world. And it's like, I thought I was talking about the real world. And then, but that's how a lot of people use it in everyday language, is what I realized is when he said real world, he meant industrial capitalism. And when college students a lot of times say the real world, how many people have ever said, what are you going to do when you get out in the real world? You know, that means, what are you going to do when you have to get a job? What I'm going to do when I get out in the real world, I'm going to roll around in the dirt, you know? That's the real world. And John A. Livingston wrote this great book called The Fallacy of Wildlife Conservation. One of the things he talked about in there is how we evolved living in a real physical world. Imagine that. And how, if you're put into an echo chamber, if you're put into a sensory deprivation chamber, you begin to hallucinate. And he says that cities are giant echo chambers, because every sensory input, how's that for a nice word? Every sensory perception that you have is mediated or created by human beings. It comes from one source. Right now, in this moment, what is anybody perceiving that was not created or mediated by human beings? In this moment, nothing. Okay, one thing.
There's an HVAC system that's been mediated.
Oh, yeah. HVAC. HVAC system. It's been mediated. That's been mediated. Everything has been mediated. And one of the questions I ask is, how many machines do you have a daily relationship with? How many wild animals do you have a daily relationship with? If I say the words Brad and Angelina,
Thank you so much.
Thanks. Have a great night. If I say the words Brad and Angelina, okay, now they're gone. Let's gossip about them. if I say the words Brad and Angelina, probably a lot of you know who or what I'm talking about. And at the same time, like I said earlier, how many people in here can name 10 species of edible plants and fungi within 100 yards of your home? I can't. There's two of you? Three of you? Can you?
10 in from my home in North
Carolina? Yeah, not here.
Yeah.
Okay, so 4, 5 people, 6 people. Okay, let's say 15 people. one of the reasons we don't defend the place we live is because we don't live there, you know? We live. We know all these abstract things. We know all these distant things. But one of the things we have to do is to get back in the real world. And this is crucial for any number of reasons, one of which is that if your experience, not your head, not your heart, but your experience is that your food comes from a grocery store and your water comes from a tap, you'll defend to the death the system that brings those to you. And if your food comes from a land base and your water comes from a river, you'll defend to the death those because your life depends on it. It's what you consider real. I was talking to my mom just this morning, and she was quoting that line back to me about how we will defend what is real. And she said 25%, 50%, something like 50% of the people in the House of Representatives, etc., are millionaires. And they are defending what is real to them. And Hitler was defending what is real to him. The purity of the Aryan race. You know, it's all bullshit we can say. And it was bullshit. That's another word. I've got to stop using bullshit. Bullshit's fine. It's all plastic, you know? It's all lies. Anyway, what is real to them is Wall Street. It's not even the economy. But it's Wall Street. There's a great line by this Brazilian general in the 1960s. Somebody asked him how the economy of Brazil was doing, and he said, the economy is doing well, the people not so well. And so there's this absolute distance, you know? Salmon aren't real. Hammerhead sharks aren't real. None of that's real. That's still abstract. And so, even though he's gone, I want to take that back to what is real. And I've been talking a lot, so I'd like for you to talk for a while. Why don't you take the next question? Anybody have a question for her?
I have a question. You mentioned you don't pay taxes. I want to know how you do that. And any suggestions on how I don't have to do that?
Well, one way that you cannot do that is instead of, if you're working for someone else, like I do promotion for charities in the fall of every year at the federal government kind of a thing. And so I have my own business, technically. And when you have your own business, you are required to pay taxes on your own quarterly. So if you choose not to pay them, you can choose not to do that. And in the United States, I got this information from the war tax resistance people. If you're in the United States, they generally won't take property. So I have a little trailer, and it's on common property with a whole other group of people, so they can't do anything with that. I don't have credit. I don't use banks. I do everything in cash. I don't own anything that anyone could take away from me. I mean, I have this little trailer. It's worth $2,800. Okay. But that's it. That's all I have. Absolutely. And it's really horrible what the government will do, because I do some peace work, like, you know, Women for Peace kind of a stuff. We stand and do vigils and junk like that. And this one woman has been a nun all her life, and she's like, you know, 72 or whatever, and she went to Cuba with Witness for Peace. The federal government said she shouldn't go to Cuba with Witness for Peace. So they actually went in to her bank account to take money from her Social Security check. She's like this little old nun, you know, at 72, and they will go in your bank account, and they will take money from Social Security that they put, you know, that they put in there. So I don't use banks or don't do any of that stuff. So it depends on what you're willing to risk. If you're willing to risk credit type stuff, like I don't have any credit because I don't use credit for anything. And if you're willing to risk those kinds of things, then you don't have to pay taxes. Or you can live below taxable income. But for me, I've just chosen to have my own company, technically, and just not pay the quarterly payments that I'm supposed to do. So that way my boss, who hires me a couple months a year, is able to turn in every year, what do they call those things, 990s, 940s, no, 990s is not profit. Something else, what is it?
1099.
So he can turn in the 1099 and say he paid me $15,000 this year, but he won't get in trouble because I'm technically responsible for sending in the stuff with them. And so I've been doing this for many, many years, and it works pretty well. Yeah.
I was told by someone who hasn't been paying taxes for a long time that if you don't make enough money, then it's not worth it for them to go after you. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's true, but if you think that when they do the analysis of what they would gain, the cost of pursuing you, it makes them not worth it.
Yeah, I would hope that it would be that logical. That's not always the case, though. Sometimes, you know, you can be a small, very small fish, and just like with drug busts, the very small fish are the ones that get imprisoned, and the big people don't. And it's the same with Madoff and whatever, some of these people.
Yeah, if that were the case, then they would, if they were just doing simple economic analyses, they would go after the corporations, because that's where the money is. But so there's, and then add to that your political work, and that's going to add some extra possible flags.
It's possible, but you know, some friends of mine were down in Honduras, and they wanted me to get arrested with them there, and they decided not to use their passports, because they said that's a privilege that they have so that they could get out. So they took them from Honduras and doing some action there, and they put them in a prison in Florida, and they were so difficult in the prison in Florida, organizing prisoners to do actions and stuff, but they actually just kicked them all out of prison. So there's just a lot of angles that you can get into once you really want to do this stuff. Any more questions? Yeah.
Can you tell us about where you live?
I live at a place called Earth Haven Eco Village. It's on the web. I don't use computers, and I don't use the web, so I don't know what it looks like, but I've heard that it's on there. Huh?
It looks nice.
Does it? Okay. And it's 320 acres, and there's about 60 people there. And it's interesting when I'm hearing people talk about these words, because in our community, we could take a year to discuss a word like agriculture. Mm-hmm. And so my opinion of that, of course, is if you were starving, we would know what agriculture was tomorrow. And it wouldn't be a year-long discussion. The only reason people can do these kind of discussions is because of our privilege. But that's,
is true for discussions of violence, too.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, who is in the position where we can decide what we're going to talk about today? Should we talk about sustainable? The word sustainable means thousands of different things to different people, and all those people live in my community. You know, so it's really hard to get, people have really, one of the things about consensus and that kind of idea that we're all empowered and we can all say what we believe and stuff is that people come up with the most nitpicky, I mean, you can say what you believe and someone else can have the most nitpickiest difference. It can be like this big and they're going to have to say it. So you can spend a lot of time having discussions
panties.
You don't want to have. I hate that word.
Sorry. But still, throw away a whole book over that word. It's just crazy.
I didn't throw away the book.
I'm
just
telling
you. I hate that word. But anyway, so it's an interesting community. It's kind of what we call eco-capitalism, which means everybody has to come up with their own bucks, and we buy into the community, and you can build kind of a house you want or whatever. So there's everything from 11-foot, 3/4 inch by 11-foot, 3/4 inch, which means you're just beneath 12-12. 12-12 is when they start deciding to call you a house. So if you have something that's 11 3/4 by 11 3/4, you're still in a shed. And so you don't have the same kind of stuff. And so we do a lot of experimenting there, which is why so many intentional communities are in places like North Carolina, South Carolina, Virginia, because the laws are very different and they allow for experimentation with composting toilets and gray water systems and stuff like that that are really hard to pull through in a place like Connecticut or Massachusetts or any of these northern states that are more codified, as it were. But it's an interesting experiment, and I haven't learned a whole lot there about living simply, because I came in knowing a lot about living simply. But in terms of trying to live with a group of people, when I got arrested last year, one of the things I had to say as I was walking through the group of protesters is it's so much easier to protest than it is to govern. Governing is hard. It takes a lot of maturity and cooperation and all kinds of stuff that, you know, people think, oh, I'm just going to go, we'll just be able to live, when everything collapses, we'll just be able to live together in community. And I'm thinking, there's more to it than that. There's a lot more to it. So in that way, those are the things that I'm really learning, is a lot of that inner, that kind of inner work there of listening to people more carefully, empathic, stuff like that. So
one of the things that my friend Jeanette Armstrong said to me, she's Okanagan Indian, she said, you know, we in our communities have just as many squabbles as, you know, you white people do, but the big difference is we know that my great-grandchild might marry your great-grandchild, and so we've had to come up with sustainable methods of conflict resolution and sustainable methods of, I mean, everybody ends up hating each other once in a while.
Oh, yeah, and definitely.
What are you going to do about that?
Yeah. Yeah.
Can you tell us some about where you started to learn about and how you developed your knowledge about living simply? And or gained your knowledge. And also, if you have, can you talk about communication between intentional communities and whether or not that's happening?
Communication between intentional communities? Well, there's massive, as you know, an intentional communities network. There's an intentional communities book. There's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of intentional communities in the United States and Canada and Europe. We are part, our community is part of GEN, which is the Global Eco Village Network. And that's a global thing, and there's probably 20 eco villages on the planet right now or whatever, depending on how you determine and define yourself or whatever. I think that I just started out early, liking camping and liking a lot of that stuff. I just liked that really early. But when I was in my late 20s, I moved to Ann Arbor, Michigan. And Ann Arbor, Michigan is like this place, is like Ithaca, New York, is like Gainesville, Florida, is like Asheville, North Carolina. These are training towns. These are places where you can go and there's going to be food co-ops, there's going to be holistic healing, there's going to be recycling, there's going to be all those alternative methodologies in place already. So if you go there with an open mind and a participatory framework like I did, then you can really learn a lot really fast. And so I went to Ann Arbor and it was just like that. I mean, there was just hundreds and hundreds, thousands of people that were participating. We had a food co-op and we had a bakery and we had, I mean, it was just all right in a row. So you could really learn things quickly. And so I find voluntary simplicity to be fun in a culture where everybody wants to make money. It's just fun, this ostentatious underconsumption to just mess with people's minds. It's just an adventure. I mean, it's just an adventurous thing, you know. Oh, so I lose my watch band or whatever. This is elastic. I just sew a piece of elastic on it. Okay, is anybody going to go, oh, that's awful, that's elastic. I would, and I think it's cool. Cut my own hair. I've always cut my own hair. I mean, I just think it's cool. You think it's funky? I'm saving money. This is following my guidelines for what I want to do with my life and my resources. I don't know another word I should use. But so it's like, it's this game thing. You know, it's like I tell people that come to Earth Haven that are my age, I say, your kids are grown. Once your kids are grown and gone, you can do whatever you want. Okay? Because your kids are like, we need a car, Mom. We want to be in a regular house like regular people. You know, okay, whatever. But when you get old, you can go build a tree house. You can play. You can do, you don't have to live in 3-4 bedrooms. You don't have to do that. You can let go of that if you choose, and you can use your time and energy and money. If you got a big house, hey, 10 people living in it, I can see that. But don't be 2 people in there. I have problems. So it's just kind of how do you see this living thing as an adventure? How do you stay where a lot of you all are coming from now without going into the big, heavy adult reality? Because so many people that are in college, as you know, they're writing stuff down for their resume. They're living in a co-op house in college, and then they're writing on a resume. Or they're vegetarian. Oh, that can go down on a resume, too. I've never filled out a resume, so I'm in a different position for sure. Yeah.
Just to add on what you just said, I'm having, like, a hard time coping of, like, why I'm here. As to, like, I feel as though it's so formulaic, high school, college, resumes. Like, I'm at my prime. I could be doing a lot of stuff that I love. I'm, like, miserable trying to stress over implicit differentiation, whatever. Whatever the fuck it's called. Like, I have an exam next week, and, like, to put it into perspective, what the hell is going to, like, what impact does this have on my life? Why can't I just be enjoying life for what it is? I see you. I mean, like, I would aspire to be like you. I think you live a great life. Like, in relevance, the importance of being here, I'm like struggling to find worth in it. And I don't know, any advice as to whether this is really, in reality, preparing me for a life that I would want to be worth living, or if I should invest my time in other things?
Well, the question always is, and we talked about this before, right? Sacred task. Didn't we mention this earlier? We mentioned the idea of a sacred task. Okay, if you have the idea of a sacred task is, that is like, what is it in your heart and in your being that says you are going to contribute? You want to contribute. Because I'd be one, is there anybody here that does not want to contribute to a life of easier living for everybody, everything, whatever, a simpler way of living without all this complexity? Is anybody doesn't want to live that way? Is there anybody that really just wants to have a lot of money and say, fuck everybody else?
Yeah.
Let me see those hands. Let me see them. Seriously, people want to contribute. People want to be part of a community. People want to be able to give of themselves. People want to be able to use their intelligence and creativity. I believe that. And I think money is like this really secondary, awful thing that they got to keep putting up in front of you to say, see, this is what you really want, right? This is what you really want. A flat screen, right? This is what you really want. It's kind of like the way they do it with the word God. And they have to keep saying he, because everywhere you look, the female of the species is given birth. It ain't no he. So they got to keep saying that to keep you in that illusion about this, about patriarchy and all that kind of stuff. So if you can look at what it is that you really have to contribute and go into your heart about that, then you can decide if you're going to spend this money, or your parents are going to spend this money, or if you're going to have this loan for who knows how long, or if you can, you're really learning something that's going to allow you to serve. There's a book that I just read, which I thought was pretty good, and it's for teenagers, actually, but I just read it, so that shows you why. And it's called The Teenage Liberation Handbook, and it's a de-schooling handbook, and it's for teenagers, but it's about looking at what school really does, what's the purpose of school, what should you be in school, what you might be able to do not in school, what some other kids who have chosen not to do that school scene, what they've chosen to do. And I felt it was just a really good book. I read it about 6 months ago, and I just felt it was really useful. I mean, you didn't have to get like pregnant like I did and kicked out of high school. I mean, that's not the easy way to do it. There's easier ways to do this than that. So, go ahead.
What year are you in school?
This is my first semester, and I find like no motivation to be here. It sucks.
Okay, so I'm gonna answer a little bit differently than if you were a junior or senior.
Sorry?
I'm gonna answer a little bit differently than if you were a junior or senior. One of the smartest things that my mom said to me was when I was a junior in college. She said, would you rather go the rest of your life saying you have a degree in physics, or would you rather go the rest of your life saying you have 3 years toward a degree in physics? And that sentence really convinced me to stay one more year. And that was really helpful, because through my 20s, I think the most I probably ever made in a year was probably $3,000 or $4,000, and that was exceptional. Usually what I did was called deficit spending, or, you know, voluntary simplicity, really. And cadging. But I had a safety net, because at any moment I could have quit and got a job at 35K working in physics back in the 80s. And had I quit when I was a junior, my backup plan, my safety net, would have been, would you like fries with that? And I never did get a job that way, but for me, I'm not saying for you or for anybody else, but for me it was really important to have, I can be extremely courageous as long as I know my back's covered.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so I had, you didn't have that safety net, it doesn't sound like.
Mm-mm.
I had a big safety net that at any moment I could have picked up the phone and called up a headhunter and said, hey, I would like to go to work for Lawrence Livermore Labs and sell my soul, and could I please speak to the devil? And being able to do that gave me the courage to, I was poor enough at some points, I was collecting cans to buy enough, to get enough that I could buy peanut butter, you know? And am I going to buy, I'm sure you've been there, and it's like, am I going to buy an orange or an apple? I was on food stamps for about 3 months, And it was so cool to actually go into the grocery store and get both an apple and an orange. Can you believe how great this is? It's like, I still make less than I ever would have made. Some people say I got in this for money, which is just bullshit. Because I still, that's what the anarchist thing is like, oh, he's talking about revolution for many. It's like, Jesus Christ, you know, if I would have, I still have not made as much as I would have started at in 1983. So it's just crazy. I mean, the most I've ever made so far is 25K. But I am so happy because I am rich enough now. I know a restaurant's a bad thing, but if I go to a restaurant, I can get an appetizer. I have fucking arrived. You know, that was about 5 years ago. I can go to a dentist. I finally got my teeth cleaned. How cool is that? I know, I mean, there's a certain level of voluntary simplicity. I mean, I live pretty simply myself, and that's great. And then there are times when it can also, it's like, how am I going to go to the dentist? You know, I have incurable progressive disease, and I now have insurance. But a couple years ago, I had $15,000. 4 years ago, I had $15,000 worth of hospital bills. What do you do with $15,000 worth of hospital bills when you make $25,000? It's a really fucking bad place to be. And at the time, I was making $18,000. So my point is that I was able to be so courageous because I couldn't do it now because I don't even remember differential equations at this point. But you know, for a long time, I could have gone another direction. And I still have a backup plan. I could always teach at a university if I had to. So I still have a backup plan, which allows me to be this courageous. But since your first year, I don't know what the hell to tell you. That makes it much more difficult. Because one thing to say, okay, put up with one more year, you know? And then when I graduated, by the way, I told my mom I didn't want to stay in physics. And she said, great, don't stay in it. And I said, well, wait, I just wasted 4 years. And she said, well, it's better than wasting your life. So my mom was like, she was very wise in terms of, yeah, hang in there for one more year, and then you'll have this safety net. But I don't know what she would say. Actually, you should call my mom. that's what elders are for.
That's,
you know,
what elders,
it's like,
are for.
Because I didn't know. I was so unhappy. And what did I do? I went to my mom. And my mom didn't say, oh, you know. I mean, she was great. And I don't know what to tell you about that except, you know, talk to your mom or somebody else's mom. I mean, if you're, talk to her.
I teach here and I tell my students, if you are bored in class, say something. I mean, the amount of boredom that is on this campus is mind-boggling. So you are the paying customers. If you are not motivated, if you're not excited, if you're not learning, stand up and say, I'm so sick of PowerPoint. Learn how to teach. Go back to school. Get the hell out of the class. Teenager's Guide to, that sounds like a great book.
What's your name?
Phoebe Godfrey.
I'd like to take that a step further. My advice to you would be a little bit different. You know, this whole thing about words that we have is sort of a metaphor for what's actually kind of happening for you. What I see is not so much what word we use, but how other people's perception, other people's words change our perception of ourselves. So what I would say is, you know, rather than look at what's been going on or what system you're in or whatever, you really need to perceive what, you know, what's real for you. And, I mean, I'll take some time off, man, figure that out before I would go through more school. School is the biggest way that we have to indoctrinate everyone into all these words that you're all talking about, all these ideas that are corrupting us and how we're destroying our planet. And I mean, school is horrible. And you know, I'm glad to see that there are a lot of students here, but I mean, we really do need to change the way that we perceive ourselves. And, you know, fuck all these words, but, you know, it's one thing to use a word in a particular way, but to allow others to use that word to help us define ourselves, which is what I think is kind of happening to you, is really not a good thing.
Well, people in here know I wrote a book on education, right?
Yeah.
It's called self-promotion here. The first two sentences are two of my best first sentences of any book, and they are, as is true for most people I know, I've always loved learning. As it's also true for most people I know, I always hated school. Why is that? I mean, school accomplishes an extraordinary thing, which is to make people not like learning.
Mm-hmm.
That's a really extraordinary accomplishment.
you know, who was it, Hume or Locke or one of them said that education is not the filling of a pail, it's the lighting of a fire. And I have no idea why that fire was lit in me, Catholic schools, whatever. I don't know. But I have loved to learn all my life. But I'll tell you this, every September, I think to myself, oh, I'm so glad I don't have to go to school. I'm 64 and I'm still saying, I'm so glad I don't have to go to school. But I love to learn, you know. And so it's like this whole different dynamic. And once you can maybe take yourself more out of the expectation of a particular career, making a certain amount of money with a certain kind of expectations, with the 40 or 50 or 60 hours a week, with sitting in front of a damn computer 8 hours a day, whatever, once you can take your talent outside of that and look and say, what do I really need? What do I really need to survive? How big of a space do I need? How can I get along with other people? How might I be able to not spend so much money? How can I, you know, resale shops, hello, every bit, everybody knows. We got a free store at our community, so I also get stuff at the free store. But that whole dynamic, I think, is a really useful thing to examine at this point in time so that you can make those decisions. Yeah.
Just a sec. I wanted to say something about that, which is that I went to school after high school three times, and I hated two of them. The first one was because I got a scholarship, and because if you go to calculus in high school, then you're supposed to go to engineering school. And I actually tried to transfer out of the Colorado School of Mines to the University of Colorado to take writing, and I went into the registrar's office, and the registrar said, wait a second, you have a scholarship to the School of Mines, and you want to transfer to the University of Colorado in English? Are you out of your mind? I was like, well, okay. And then I went back to School of Mines. And then the second time, then I went to graduate school for 1 year because I had a year of eligibility left for high jumping. And this is a terrible reason to go to school, too. And that was just miserable. But then I went back when I was 29 or 28 or something. I went back and I got an MFA in creative writing. And the reason I went to school then is because I had learned as much as I could from dead writers. And I wanted to learn how to write better, and I wanted to have a teacher who could talk back, as opposed to, with whom I can't ask Dostoevsky questions, you know? I can, but I'm not always sure of the answers. And, of course, that's true from reading his books, too. And anyway, and I loved it. And part of the reason I loved it is because I took absolute control of my own education. I said, you know what? You don't offer a playwriting minor? I want a playwriting minor. So, how do we make this happen? And I never would have had the confidence to do that in college, the first time. And besides which, I hated science anyway, so. And the only good thing I got out of my degree in science is now I'm a strong critic of science. I think science is bullshit. And then I'll say science is bullshit, and people will say, oh my God, that's blasphemy. I'm like, oh yeah, I have a bachelor's in science, or a bachelor's in mineral engineering physics from Colorado School of Mines, and your degree is in communications? Let's talk about science for a while. So it gives me some credibility, you know? But it's just bullshit. Yeah, it's a BS in mineral engineering physics with an emphasis in BS. So, yeah, just I want to echo what they both said about taking charge, but there's also the fact that you're then, what, 19?
18.
And so I have a couple questions, and these are rhetorical. I don't expect you to have answers right now. I would not have had these. I would have hated my books if I read them at 18. At 18, I would have thought I was some sort of fucking communist, pinko, agitator, bad guy. Does that mean that you agree that I'm a communist, pinko, agitator?
I like communists.
Okay. Well, this was a bad thing when I was 18. I voted for Ronald Reagan when I was 19, for crying out loud. And
I voted for Nixon.
Huh.
So I beat you.
Anyway, so if I had read my books in high school, I would have hated them. In college, they would have troubled me and I wouldn't have understood them. By the time I was a senior in college, I would have needed them. And by the time I was 24, 25, I would have been hungry for them. So You know, my point is that we evolve, but I'm going to ask these questions just to plant them. First one is, what are the largest, most pressing problems you can help to solve using the gifts that are unique to you and all the universe? What are the largest, most pressing problems you can help to solve using the gifts that are unique to you and all the universe? That may change over time. You know, and I wouldn't have been able to say, you know, when I was 18, I would not have been able to say what they are. But now I can say what they are. There's a huge hole in our discourse. There's a hole in discourse. There are 2 million dams in the United States, 70,000 dams over 13 feet tall, 60,000 dams over 13 feet tall, 70,000 dams over 6.5 feet tall. If we only took out one of those dams every day, it would take 200 years to take out those dams. Salmon don't have that time and sturgeon don't have that time. I looked around, I saw a big hole in our discourse. I didn't see any environmentalists talking about fighting back. I didn't see anybody talking about how this culture is psychopathological. I didn't see very many people, I didn't see any men making the connections between rape and environmental degradation. Women, I didn't see any men doing it. Okay, there's my job. I got my task laid out for me. And I couldn't have done that at 18. And the other thing is, and also this would have changed over time, is what do you get off on? What do you get off on doing? I mean, one of the reasons I've written so many books is because I get off on doing what I do. And that's different than what do you love. You know, I love the salmon. I know that's really deep and meaningful and everything. It's like, what do you get off on? It's much more just, what do you get off on doing? And it's like I was hanging out with this wetland specialist. I love this story. Hanging out with this wetland specialist. We were working together to stop a subdivision. Development's another word I don't like. Working together to stop a subdivision and to stop the murder of some trees. And he was digging in the dirt, and they'd rub his fingers between the, rub the soil between his fingers, and they would compare the color of the soil to a chart, and that would help him determine whether these are wetland soils. And I looked at him and I said, do you get off on doing this? He said, oh, yeah. This is my second favorite thing to do in the world after playing with my dogs. And I said, well, that's great, because this would be hell for me. On the other hand, I've condemned myself to a life of homework, you know? I get off on trying to figure out the relationship between perceived entitlement, exploitation, and atrocity. I mean, I get so excited by, like, that stuff that I wrote, that I read. You know, that was the best part of the whole airplane trip, which, you know, frankly, it was an airplane trip. It's not very fun anyway. But, you know, it's just, I get off on trying to figure out how it is, this is the book I'm working on right now, how it is that if indigenous peoples have had really intense and good relationships with beings on other sides, how is it that the dominant culture has always been able to kill them? And how is it that if the earth really is intelligent, which I fully believe, if the earth is sentient, why hasn't it killed us off? Mm-hmm. It's like, goddamn, why did smallpox go the wrong direction? And why did, you know, it's so, it just pisses me off. You know, October 12th is Columbus Day, and
Invader's Day.
Yeah, exactly. And the day of mourning.
Yes, exactly.
And did you know that there was a mutiny on Columbus's ship? Do you know this? A mutiny on Columbus's ship on October 11th, and they said, we're going back. And he said, give me one more day. Oh. Fuck! God damn, you know? I mean, why that fucking day? And it was moonlight. You know, they saw moonlight shining off the beach. Why wasn't it cloudy that night? Tell me that. Why wasn't it cloudy? Or there were so many attempts made to kill Hitler. So many attempts. It's like a Monty Python movie where he's walking around and there's just like, you know, swords falling behind him. He doesn't see him. There was an attempt on Hitler's life made that failed because a fly landed on somebody's hand. For real. I'm not making that up. Because a fly landed on somebody's hand, the attempt failed. There were times where they put bombs in a plane of Hitler's, and he took off, and they were altitude dependent to go off, and the timers went off. I'm not the timers. The what's it called? The explosives? The detonators. The detonators went off. Didn't set off the explosives. Another time, Hitler was in Russia, and some tanks were able to break through the German lines, and they got up to the airport where Hitler was going to take off. They ran out of gas at the edge of the airport. It's like, something's going on here, you know? And so, that's the book I'm doing right now. I totally get off on trying to figure out. Okay, so I'm going to give some of my answers real quick. One of the answers, maybe science is right, and the world really is dead. And just, humans are the only intelligence in the entire universe. Everything else is just dead matter. And so when the Indians were praying, they were just praying to nobody, you know? And when I say, why hasn't the earth fought back? That's like asking why the toolbox doesn't, you know, bite you when you try to reach in for a wrench, you know? Maybe science is right. I don't think so, but maybe. That's one possibility. Maybe the Christians are right. You know, maybe there's only one God, and maybe he's just one nasty motherfucker. You know? He's like, the Christian God, he's a really bad piece of work, you know? And besides, he's really weird. Okay, first off, he's omniscient, He's omnipotent. He's the only God, and he's jealous? It's like,
and there's a devil.
Get some counseling, dude. You know. So maybe the Christians are right. You know, and there's only one God, and he just, and you know why he's so pissed off? You know why he hates bodies so much? Because he's several billion years old, and he doesn't have a body, which means he's never had an orgasm. It's like, that is a long fucking time to go without an orgasm. So he's just pissed off. It's like, they're having an orgasm. That's bad. So, okay, or maybe there are a lot of gods, but just the Christian God was strong. Or maybe God's a machine, because you know the machines are really winning. I mean, machines are winning. We are serving the machines. I mean, we think that that this culture is actually winning. We're dying of fucking cancer, you know? But the machines are proliferating everywhere. So God's this big fucking machine. He's a big bulldozer or something, you know? I mean, I don't know. I'm throwing out I actually don't think those are the ideas. The real truth, and this is where I'm just about to write this, what I really think it is that I think that the dominant culture has been much better at gaining sacrifices. You have to give things to these other beings to there's an exchange. You give them something. And I think that all the women who are raped, I think all the species who are driven extinct, I think those are sacrifices to nasty forces who don't wish us well. I think the dominant culture sacrifices all those beings to some bad ones. I don't know. That's my best guess. I don't know. But the point is, I get off on trying to figure that out. So I am going to give you some advice, which is, whether you stay in school or not, I actually don't care. I don't think that's the important question. I can say that because I'm not in school. My advice to you would be, whether you stay in school or not, that you spend the next 5 or 6 years figuring out what you love enough that you would live your life for it, and what you love enough that you would die for it, and what you love enough that you would that you will spend your life in service to. And also to figure out, so three things. What do you love enough that you would, like, I love the salmon. I would give my life for the salmon in a heartbeat. What do you love enough that you will live your life in service to? I know the woman who used to run the battered women's program for the state of New York. She's relentless. Every man she sees, she asks, what will it take for men to stop beating on women? Get in a taxi cab with this woman. She says, I'd like to go to Central Park. What will it take for men to stop beating on women? Do not get on the subway with this woman. I mean, she's relentless. And what is there that you feel so strongly about? You know, and frankly, when I was 18, 19, what I felt strongly enough about was high jumping. And that's okay, you know? But for then, I lived my life. That's what got me through college, was I loved high jumping so much. And so what is there that you love? Because it's your life. It's not my life. It's not your life. It's not your life. It's not your life. It's not your parents' life. It's not your counselor's life. It's not your teacher's life. It's your life. You're the one who's got to live with it, and you got to live with the results. So what do you love, first? Second, what do you get off on? And third, what are your gifts? And so my advice to you, in fact, my directive to you, is to, no matter what you do, figure those out. That is your job right now. Does that help at all?
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, one more thing. It can change.
It will change.
I used to think that it should be a law that nobody should get married at 20. It's like, if you get married at 20, you deserve what happens to you. Because I dated one woman all through my 20s, and we were long distance for about 2 years in the middle, and then when we got back together, she said to me one time as we were breaking up, she said, you know, I used to think that I knew you better than you knew yourself, and now I don't even know who you are. And I remember what I thought in that moment was, I'm really glad, because I didn't like who I was when I was 20. And so I'm glad that you don't know who I am anymore, because I'm not the same person I was that when we were together before. And we changed so much. Somebody over here was going to ask something. You were going to pick somebody. I interrupted you.
I don't know. There were several people. Go ahead.
When you were talking about different housing cooperative places to live, like North Carolina and all the different places, Gainesville, and you're talking a lot about like what you're willing to do and how you're willing to live, I guess I'm just wondering what your thoughts are if you bring like a class analysis into that, because I don't think a lot of people have choice. Can't really like will yourself into like go living on a co-op if you're, you know, living in poverty with a bunch of kids or something. So I guess, to me, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it seems like if I take what you're saying and follow that path, unless you can like mix it up a little, it seems like you're saying like what we need to do, what's wrong with our society is, you know, have some sort of exodus from capitalism, like just leave it, have alternative institutions and go do that, and it'll go away, and we can all do that if we want to badly enough. And like, for me, I think we need to confront capitalism, the state, and we need to fight it. I don't think everyone has the privilege to make the choices you've made, for instance, or the choices I've made. So I'm just wondering, like, so I'm not assuming that what you're saying, if you can maybe speak to that a little bit.
Well, first of all, I come from, I guess, the middle class, although neither of my parents went to college, and I was told at my community by someone that I could not be middle class if neither one of my parents went to college. That was their definition of middle class. So my idea about cooperative living, okay, and it is opposed at a certain place to capitalism, because what we're attempting to do is live a more non-exploitive life, and that's part of the way I define capitalism, as something that is an exploitation-based lifestyle. So for me, a cooperative lifestyle is different than a capitalist lifestyle. And I don't think that they're mutually exclusive. I think that you can live a simple cooperative lifestyle and still work against capitalism and challenge capitalism and get arrested at the World Bank and whatever. I think all that can happen simultaneously. The advantage of practicing a different economic format or a different way of looking at things or a different way of sharing things, this idea of access without ownership. What does that mean? But the more that we practice those things, the more real it is, and the more we learn the details. That's why if I come and talk to people about living in a community that's off the grid, there's a lot of details in living in a community off the grid that just saying, well, you should just get solar panels and use insulated shades. You know, the details are there if you've lived that way. So if you choose to be vegetarian, which I've been vegetarian for 32 years, if you choose that, I know a lot of details about different aspects of vegetarian living, from, you know, from the raw blah, blah, blah over here to the all these other aspects that we've done, to fasting, to whatever. So as you practice those things, you begin to get insight into what can work, what can't work, what you can change. I just think it gives you a better outlook on things because you're just more knowledgeable.
Well, I completely agree with you that, like, if we need other institutions to move into, we can't just, like, leave these and have nowhere to go. Like, if we're going to get rid of capitalism, of course, we need to figure out how we're going to live, how we're going to organize ourselves differently. We're not just going to not organize ourselves. Mm-hmm. But I guess, like, my question to you is, obviously, like, creating and building and experimenting with alternative institutions to be living in, like, how do we get rid of this one that's oppressing so many people? Because that's going to help you, and that's going to help those however many people live on you know, the place where you live, where your shed is, and, like, their sheds. Like, that's going to help all of them. But what about all of us? Like, we need to liberate all of us. Like, how do you see that?
I don't see us liberating all of us immediately. That may need to happen as push comes to shove and everything goes, and all the electricity goes off, which means all the computers goes off, which means all the gasoline can't be pumped, which means I don't know that everybody really knows how much of our lives is run on electricity. I mean, I live someplace where we're off the grid, so when all these rolling blackouts and stuff happen everywhere, it doesn't happen in our community. And so it's like if we're thinking in terms of down the line, our putting an example, for instance, out in our little community, which can be done in urban areas, and urban areas are doing these transition towns, and there's just so much going on. The whole Simple Living Network, which I've never seen, but which I hear is really good, is an introduction into all this stuff. And like I said, you don't stop living, you know, you don't stop everything at once. I work for social justice. I hire women that work in a transitional shelter or live there. I mean, I try to do a lot of things at once. And having a place like we have where people come and visit, they do tours, they get inspired, we have college classes coming through, we have high school classes coming through, people volunteer and they learn to make their own, make houses and stuff. I mean, this is like an educational format. It's not done like this because we're not that plugged in, but it's, you don't have to do an either or thing. That's always.
I'm not saying that at all. I think what you're saying is very important, but I think that I was just wondering how you see the rest of the struggle. Like, obviously what you're doing is part of the struggle. I'm just trying to understand.
The rest of the struggle. You mean the stuff that other people are doing?
No, yeah, I guess. And maybe that's one way to look at it. Like, I'm doing this part and other people are doing another part. I guess, like, I'm wondering how you advocate for revolution, I guess.
Well, one way I advocate for revolution is through ostentatious underconsumption, is to just get people thinking about how we participate every day in supporting the dominant system, because it's through all of our support that everything continues to go on. So for me, the first thing to do is, I'm an underminer. One of the things I really loved is I was reading about these anti-nuclear people in Germany, and they were really against the transportation of, you know, of nuclear waste. And instead of trying to overthrow something, they dug a tunnel under the highway. So the highway collapsed, so they couldn't run the nuclear waste back and forth. That's much more my tactic. Undermining is much more my tactic than this overthrowing thing. I'm not interested in that. How do I withdraw my support? How do I withdraw my tax dollars? How do I withdraw my energy? How do I help create a whole different energy field in looking at the way that we might be able to live together and be politically active and support people that are doing stuff that it's more direct action stuff? Well, I mean, I think there's a wide variety of ways that people can attempt that, but for me, my lifestyle is first, because that gives me access to, even if I just pay attention to the way indigenous people live, and have a lot of potlucks and potlatches and share the wealth and give a bunch of stuff away like they did, that's a different way of looking at how we can interface with the rest of the world, I think.
I actually want to respond to this too.
I can see your mouth is open.
Yeah. And that's a really, really rich and important question on a bunch of levels. I want to answer a bunch of those levels, or insofar as I can. One of them is, I was sharing the stage with Karen Raffensperger, who's a good friend of mine, who's also a pacifist. And at one point, it was similar to this. And at one point, she was describing what a sustainable community would look like, and would smell like, and would feel like, and democratic decision-making processes. And the whole time, I'm doing the same thing I was doing here, which is... And finally, she turns to me and she says, "So it's very clear you want to say something, Derek." I said, "Yeah, this is all great, you're describing what it's going to look like, but right now, those in power are psychopaths. And if we have this democratic community that you're talking about, and there are resources on that land that those in power want, they will take them. They will kill you and they will take them. So how do we get there from here?" And she smiled at me very sweetly and said, "That's your job to describe, Derek." And the point is, we have different roles. That you're describing that, and I'm talking about bringing this motherfucker down. And so I don't believe in the reform versus revolution dichotomy. And one reason I don't, or the place I was where I learned it, was when I used to teach at Pelican Bay State Prison, which is a supermax. And I recognized every day that I walked in there, I was participating in the biggest racist gulag on the planet. And at the same time, a lot of my students were telling me that the only things that were keeping them sane were our classes. And so how do I join that? At that moment, the revolution versus reform dichotomy fell apart for me, because if we all wait for the great glorious revolution, which I am working every moment of my life for, that is what my life is about. I am, everything is about the pre-revolutionary phase. I mentioned the Battle of Algiers. Everything in my life, I am a recruiter for the revolution. I want to bring this thing down. I want to do it using any means necessary. Everything is about organizing for that. And we need to have organized resistance. We need to bring down this whole system. And at the same time, the fighters need to eat. And I'm going to look over at you. Because, you know, you can't... Once again, we need all that. And so that's another thing. The class analysis is... another thing that I wrote down here... on the plane was, who will do it? Because I was doing a talk in Portland about a month ago, and this one woman said, "You know, I want for the dams to come out, but I'm scared of state repression, and I don't want to do it, and who's going to do it?" And my answer to her was, one thing we need to not do is we need to make sure that we don't put the indigenous on the front line yet again. And we need to not put the poor on the front line yet again, because they're always the fucking cannon fodder for everybody. And what I wrote on the plane was, who will do it? The middle class have the luxury to do this. It's not the job of the poor or the otherwise oppressed. They're too busy staying simply alive. It is our job. There was a guy came up to me years and years ago after I wrote The Culture of Make-Believe. And he said, he was a black guy, and he was really mad at me. He said, "You know, You were able to write and publish this book because you're white." I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, they wouldn't have published this if I wrote it. And I said, no, they probably wouldn't. He said, well, you're white, and you wrote it. I said, yeah, I did, and that's why. Because if you are a member of an oppressor class, it is not the responsibility of any members of the oppressed classes to differentiate you from others of the oppressors.
That's right.
It is not your job as a woman to differentiate me from other men. It is my job as a male to differentiate myself. And where I realized this was talking to Dr. Mayo. I was thinking about going to, I was just sort of putting myself in his place. And I was like, okay, I'm going to go to Iraq and I'm going to say, hey, I don't like the American invasion. I want to help you. You know, it's like, it wouldn't be their fault if they shoot me the first day there because I'm an American. And it is my responsibility to differentiate myself. That's true on a class level. And this is one of the reasons why universities get shut down in Latin America, used to get shut down in Latin American countries, is because that's where a lot of action happened, is where you have people who have the luxury, as I do, to learn how to read. On a global level, everyone in this room is extraordinarily wealthy because we have been taught how to read and write. And that makes us extraordinarily wealthy. And it is our responsibility to use that privilege to undercut its basis. And so what happens is, a lot of times, at the universities become hotbeds of revolution, because you would get the people who had the luxury to do the theorizing would come together with those who lived directly under the iron boot of oppression. And that's where the magic occurs. It's like, I got a book coming out in 2 weeks. It's a novel about a character who is quite a bit like me, except she's a female, and she's a paper revolutionary. She knows the system is all fucked up, and she talks about it's fucked up. She works on toxic issues on inner city. And one night on the way home from work, she's waiting for the bus, and she gets mugged. And she's kind of a combative personality. As she's getting mugged, she basically says, she says to the men mugging her, you know, you think you're such a fucking big man, you know, beating up on a woman, you know, what the hell does that serve? You stay so much in line, you don't even, you know, the Vex Corps, the corporation doesn't even have to send cops down to take care of you, you know, what the fuck's wrong with you? I'm here trying to protect kids from cancer. And what she doesn't know is that the little sister of one of them just died of leukemia like 3 months before. So he gets really pissed off at her, and he beats her up, and he thinks about killing her, but he doesn't. And then he goes and talks to his brother who's in the prison, and his brother says, you know, she's right, that you are just acting out this stuff. But anyway, what he says is, if you take some gunpowder and you put it on the table and you set a match to it, all you got is stink in your house and a burn mark on the table. But if you put that behind a bullet, you got something. And his point is, direct your anger. And so he goes back to her office like 3 or 4 months later. He comes in. She's working late one night. And by now, she's bought a gun to protect herself. He comes in late at night and walks into the door. And she sees him and pulls a gun on him. And he says, you know, I came to apologize. She's like, great. Your apology accepted. Now get the hell out. It's like, no, you're right. It's like, fine, I'm right. Get the hell out of here. He goes, no. I thought about what you said, and you're right. So we did it. It's like, did what? He said, he's out in the trunk. I'm like, what? And it ends up what they did is they kidnapped the CEO of the corporation and they put him in the trunk. And she said, what'd you bring him here for? He's like, well, we figured you'd know what to do with him. I mean, you know, you were talking about how the whole system's messed up and how, you know, we need to strike back against the real oppressors. So here. So then she has a choice. She can either tell him to get lost, in which case she's showing that everything she's ever talked about is rhetoric, or she can participate in capital crime. And you learn this early in the book, but she goes ahead and participates. And then other stuff happens after that. But the point is, I think we always need to keep this class analysis, which, by the way, should also extend to an ecological analysis. I think we need to keep that in mind at every moment. And that's why I talk so often about a culture of resistance. And if Maud Gunn is just writing plays in Gaelic, it's like, I don't care. But if she does it, it's like, I did a talk in Bellingham, Washington about a year ago, and after the talk, there was one guy who was really pissed off. And it was great, because he was pissed off because, A, not many people had showed up, because the people who brought me had not done a very good promotional job, and B, he was pissed off because I came there for a day and then I left. And it's like, what are we supposed to do with this? And it's great, because what he did with that anger is he put together an organization called Fertile Ground that now they do explicitly above ground work because there has to be a firewall between above ground and below ground work. You know, otherwise we should just go to the police station for recreational mugshots, you know? So there has to be a firewall. So they do above ground work, but everything they do is about forming this culture of resistance. And everything they do is about helping to bring this culture of resistance into being. And that's what we desperately need, is this whole culture of resistance. An example of this is IRB, Irish Peppermint Brotherhood, before the IRA. This guy does an action against the British, and he gets shot while he's doing the action. So he goes off and he falls down in an alley, and he gets away from the British. And some Irish men, they were, but Irish people, on their way home from work, they see him in the alley. And no questions asked, they pick him up and they take him to a doctor. And then the doctor fixes him, no questions asked, and then he's taken to a safe house. That's a culture of resistance. And those guys are doing it too. Those guys, and they're putting their lives on the line just as much as the guy who did, you know, what are they called, the 12 apostles or the 12 disciples? The assassins, the IRA assassins? I don't remember if it's 12 apostles or 12 disciples. But anyway, they had regular jobs. And what they would do is they would check in, they would clock into the job, and then they would go do the assassination of the British occupiers, and then they would go back to work. But you know what? They never clocked out. So they were at work the whole time, and all the other people on the line, no, man, he was working, he was right here next to me the whole time. They're taking their own lives. They could have been tortured and killed too. And we all need to enter into this culture of resistance. I mean, the world is being killed. What are they going to do? What are they going to do if they get mad at us? Kill it twice, you know? It's like, and so yes, as a man, I am very aware at every moment that I have male privilege. And you know what? I am going to use the hell out of that privilege to undercut its basis. And I'm going to use the fact, I interviewed a member of the MRTA, the Tupac Amaristas, years ago, in the 1990s. That's the Japanese group that took over the Japanese ambassador's house. I mean, the Peruvian group that took over the Japanese ambassador's house. I interviewed him, and I said, one of the things he said to me was, you have been privileged enough to learn how to write. Most of the people in the MRTA are not that rich. And so you need to use that. And he said also, by the way, there have been a lot of people who have picked up both the gun and the pen. Oh, and I want to say one more thing about this too, which I think might be the most important thing I say tonight, which if you're going to write anything down, write this down, which is the task of an activist is not to navigate systems of oppressive authority. I'm sorry. The task of an activist is not to navigate systems of oppressive power with as much integrity as possible. The task of an activist is to confront and take down systems of oppressive power. The task of an activist is not to navigate systems of oppressive power with as much integrity as possible. The task of an activist is to confront and take down systems of oppressive power. And that can be done, once again, through undermining. That's why simple living as simple living, if that's the end of the story, it doesn't interest me at all. But simple living undermining, great. You got my vote for what that's worth. And, you know, because once again, we need it all. When I talk about we need to use any means necessary, I include bombs. I include guns. I include forks. I include non-forks. I include your hands. I include writing. I include pens. It's like, we need to, Andrea Dworkin. Andrea Dworkin has changed my life so much. Her analysis just blew me away. And without Andrea Dworkin's analysis, I would not be as good a feminist as I am. Without Jane Caputi's analysis. So that writing, even writing, I mean, writing is such a pointless fucking waste of time. I mean, it doesn't accomplish anything in the real world. But it helps. Neil Everton's book, Natural Alien, changed my life. It saved my life. It saved my sanity. You know? And we can build on those, and we have to build on those. And that includes Marx, obviously. I mean, all that. And class analysis central. And also, one more thing that's very important, which is that I was reading this book on an autobiography of a member of the Dutch resistance in World War II. And there was one line of it that just blew me away, which was, it's a direct quote, "The resistance was, of course, made up primarily of murderers, prostitutes, and thieves." World War II resistance. That blew me away because I always thought that the resistance was made up of upper-class British officers like Ingrid Bergman's husband in Casablanca. I mean, that's what the propaganda is. But then I read it, like, of course. And, I mean, of course it would be because they didn't care about Dutch law, so of course they're not going to care about German law. And there's, I was talking to Christopher Hedges a couple weeks ago. And he said, I said that line. He said, absolutely, it's true. He's been a war correspondent. He said, El Salvador, the resistance was primarily the criminal class, whatever that means. Hamas is primarily made up of criminals. And this leads to a huge question of, and it's not an either or, but it's something I think about a lot, do we want to radicalize militants or militantize radicals? It's a hugely important question. And the Black Panthers ask that question all the time. You know, I have talked with radicalized former drug dealers. They are so comfortable with guns, you know? And, I mean, there was a guy I was talking to that's like, when he used to do drug deals, and he's been to prison and he's out, so he can talk about whatever he wants now. But, you know, it's like they do a drug deal, everybody walks in, they put their gun on the table. And, like, this guy came in one time, didn't put a gun on the table. He said to the guy, put your gun on the table. And the guy said, I didn't bring one. He said, okay, either A, you're really stupid, or B, you're a liar, in which case, either case, I don't want to deal with you. And he just walked out. And, I mean, can you imagine? It's like when the guy down in Arizona went to the Obama's talk and he had the automatic weapons. All my friends were saying, where are the lefties with the automatic weapons? You know, why is it all only the right wingers and are the gun nuts? You know, I saw this woman had a shirt that said tree hugging gun lover, tree loving gun nut, something like that. And it's great. You know, it's like, and when this would have been part of the regular Endgame talk that when I used to, one of the reasons I wrote Endgame is because when I used to do talks about fighting back, the response by people in the audience was so predictable, which is, if I talk about fighting back, by which I can mean, you know, fighting back including filing lawsuits and everything, but also in this case, I mean fighting back means militant. And when I would talk about fighting back, the response by the audience was really predictable, which is sort of mainstream peace and social justice activists and mainstream environmental activists would put up what I've taken to calling a Gandhi shield, which is they would say names Martin Luther King, Dalai Lama, and Gandhi again really fast over and over to keep all evil thoughts at bay. And then the grassroots activists would do the same thing, but then they would come up to me afterwards and they would whisper in my ear, thank you so much for bringing this up. And then there were other groups of people that had different responses, and that is a lot of people of color, a lot of the poor, a lot of gang kids, a lot of American Indians, survivors of domestic violence, family farmers. I don't know if I already mentioned radical environmentalists. A lot of them would say, yeah, tell us something we don't know. Let's go, bro. And what I realized is that for a lot of the latter groups, violence is not some spiritual abstract question to be puzzled through. It's not a capital V violence. It's not reified. It's part of life. You deal with it. Doesn't mean you do it. Doesn't mean you don't do it. But you deal. And I bring this up in terms of class because it's a hugely important class. There's a great line by the last poets. Don't talk to me of revolution until you're ready to eat rats to survive. And when I did the talk in Chico a couple days ago, one of the questions from the audience was, how can we get people to fight back, literally, to save what's left of the planet when we ourselves are so insulated? You know, it's left to the tribes in the Amazon to actually kill cops with spears when they're getting shot. You know? That sort of courage. Or men, like I mentioned earlier, the Movement for the Emancipation of the Niger Delta has reduced oil production by 20%. And these are a bunch of half-starved people who, they don't have the luxuries that we have. And is that what it's going to take, is sloshing through oil muck before we will fight back? And what will it take for us to fight back? And that question that woman asked me at the talk in Portland about, so who is going to take out the dams? That's the question. Who will do it? Who will do it? And it's like Michael Collins in the movie, which is great except for the love triangle. There's a part where he's standing up and he's talking against the British, and you know, he says, the British are going to take me out. It was the Irish that took him out, which is a horizontal hostility, which is something else we can talk about. But anyway, he says, when I get taken out, who will take my place? And one of the important things, one of the reasons that those in power have been able to kill so much of the planet, there's this great line by Thomas Jefferson talking about the Indians. He said, in war, they may kill some of us, we shall destroy all of them. That's it. That's why they always win. Because they have that level of fucking determination. And us, it's like, oh, I might get hurt. And there's that level of intensity. What would happen? I mean, think about this. If there's a protest, you know, there might be one person throw something at a cop. But what is the attitude of the cops? The attitude of the cops is, you know what? You may hit one of us with a rock. We're going to take out every fucking one of you. That's the attitude they have every time. What if we had that attitude and we had zero tolerance? What if we, in our community, said we are going to enforce cancer-free zones? What if we said we are going to enforce rape-free zones? How many people in here have heard of the Gulabi gang? The Pink Sari gang? Aren't they great? They're amazing. There's this group of women in India that they wear pink saris and they take, they do martial arts. They go through the villages, and if they see a man beating up a woman, they beat the shit out of him. This is happening right now. It's the Gulabi Gang. And this happened in Maoist China right after the revolution. There were women who would go through the villages, and they would say, you know, they would, if they saw a man beating up a woman, they'd beat the shit out of him. If they saw him do it again, they'd kill him. We cannot count on the police to protect us. 6% of men who commit rape spend even one night in jail. And we can't count on the police to protect us from cancer. It's their job to enforce the dictates of capital, as you know, which means it falls to us. And then the question is, and people have said, God, Derek, you can't take out a dam, because if you take out a dam, they're just going to put it up again. That is such bullshit. What would happen if we were members of the Russian resistance in World War II and the Germans build a warehouse? What do? We burn it down. What do the Germans do? They build it up. What do we do as members of resistance? And then they build it again. What do we do then? And then they build it again. What do we do then? And then we get sick of that, then we just kill the Germans. But the point is, we need to match their intensity. Those on the other side know what they want. They want every last fish in the ocean. They want every last tree. And we need to match that. And we need to say, this is where I live. And this is... Actually, there's something I would like to read. And are you okay with closing here? Or do you want to keep going? Either way is okay with me. Because I have a good thing to close with if we're going to close.
Wait, before you close, may I ask a
question? Okay, I'm going to say this and then we won't close. How's that? Because I want to read this because it really applies to this. And this is how I usually close my talks. A few of the bravest Cheyenne dog soldiers will be chosen to wear sashes of tan skins called dog ropes. Attached to each dog rope is a picket pin, normally used to tether horses. During battle, the pin would be driven into the ground as a mark of resolve. Once the pin was driven, the dog soldier would remain staked to that piece of ground even to the end, even to the death. Retreat was no longer an option. The pin could only be removed when everyone was again safe or when another dog soldier relieved him of his duty. It is time. I have driven my picket pin. I am staked out and willing to give in no more. Where will you drive your own picket stake? Where will you choose to make your stand? Give me a threshold, a specific point at which you finally stop running, at which you finally fight back. Stand with me. Stand and fight. I am one, we would be two. Two more might join and we would be four. When four more join, we will be eight, and we'll be eight people fighting whom others will join, and then more people, and more. Stand and fight. The questions before each of us now are, what are your gifts and how can you use them in the service of your land base? What can you do? What does your land base most need from you? How can you achieve it? What do you want to do? And right now, perhaps the most important of all, what are you willing to do? So, a question?
Yeah, my question is really practical, actually. Can you just address how the state has developed techniques and over the years and learned over the years, over the centuries, really, how to oppress resistance and revolution? For example, someone pointed out there's a camera in here, and you mentioned that the nun, her bank account, the money was taken out of it, and, you know, through our cell phones and our credit cards and things, we're being kept track of all the time. So can you just address how that, we need to keep that in mind, with also building the resistance?
I think... how many people in here know the concept of the panopticon? Okay. Very important concept. I'm sorry?
Very postmodern. Foucault.
Yeah. I learned a lot from Foucault on that. Well, for those of you who don't, the panopticon is a prison design that is where you have the central guard tower, and then all the cells are radial from there. And what this means is that if the guard tower is always kept dark and the cells are kept lit, it means that the guard tower, that the surveillance is, in Foucault's word, always possible, never verifiable, which means there may be a guard there, but you can't tell if you're a prisoner when they're looking at you. So we can't tell if they're looking at us, okay? And what this means is very effective, not just a prison design, but as a way to design society, because you never know when they're looking at you, so you police yourselves. It's like Stephen Biko said, that the most powerful tool in the hand of the oppressor is the mind of the oppressed. And so we police ourselves. But there's also a South African head of security for South Africa during apartheid said that the thing they were afraid most of from the ANC was not the sabotage or even the violence, as it was that the mass of South Africans would learn to not respect law and order as such. Because there is no security force in the world that can stand up to people who don't believe that there is a relationship between law and morality, who don't believe that laws must be followed simply because they're laws. What are laws? Laws are rules made by the rich for the rich. And there are, I'm not saying we shouldn't have laws against rape. I got no problem with laws against rape. It'd be nice if they were enforced, actually. But we have to recognize that there is not a correspondence between law and morality. And we need to break away from that. And then we can act practically. And then there are questions. How do you organize within a panopticon? We all have to take different approaches to that. My own approach is because, okay, I am above ground. And I don't break the law, except sometimes I shoplift dog food from Walmart. And that's like a sacrament. But apart from that, I don't break the law. One of the reasons is because I have a big bullseye on my chest. After a talk I did one time, this guy shook my hand, and I took my hand away, there's a little piece of paper in it that said, after the talk, let's go fuck some shit up in the parking lot. And it's like, you are not getting me that easy, Mr. Fedman. You know, I'm not that stupid. So there have to be, one of the things we have to do is to start instituting, within a panopticon, especially instituting good security culture rules. People know about the Green Scare. The victims of the Green Scare, okay, the non-cooperating defendants, I will never say anything against them. The non-cooperating defendants were very courageous, and I support them as a member of the above ground. As a member of the above ground, what we need to provide to below ground people is material support and loyalty. And we need, those of us above ground, need to speak out as often as we can, as explicitly and forcefully as we can, at every moment. And the people below ground, okay, having said, I'm not going to say anything bad about the non-cooperating defendants, which I'm not. There were some mistakes made in the whole Green Scare thing. One of the reasons it fell apart is because one of the people in our group was a heroin addict. I'm not saying all heroin addicts are bad, but I'm saying, are you going to trust your life to a heroin addict? They did. Many of them were sleeping with each other. And that ended up being used by the feds. One of the tape recordings was of two of the guys talking to each other. One of them saying to the other one, yeah, she's kind of fat. And the other one saying, she's really bad in bed, too. And they played this for the woman. I mean, she wants to protect those guys after that? I mean, and plus, you know, relationships, romantic relationships can get messy anyway. So let's add, and then you're living underground, all this stuff. It's like, that adds a layer of complexity. I'm not saying people shouldn't sleep with each other. I'm saying that triangulation can get really messy in a situation like that. More people knew about actions than should have known. Oh, they talked about actions after they were done. The way it fell apart was Jake, the snitch, who has had nothing happen to him, by the way. Jake, the snitch, went to the cops, and then after that put on a wire and went to his friends and said, or his ex-friends, went to the other Green Scare people and said, hey, remember when we did this? Remember the good old days? And they should have said, Jake, what are you talking about? You must have been high, you know? I never went out there. What are you talking about? You know, it's like, don't talk about this stuff. Need to know basis. It's like, also, if you want to know, here's my real answer. I can say this easily in California. I don't know about Connecticut, but I live in Northern California. Do the words Northern California and marijuana happen to go together for anybody here? It's like, it's not possible to live in Northern California without knowing somebody who is involved. One out of every six houses in Arcata is a grow house. That's not an exaggeration. And so one of the things I think, and so I can easily say in California, if you want to know how to communicate and organize within a panopticon, talk to your neighbor because they're probably a grower, you know? It's like, talk to growers and find out how they organize, how they communicate. That's cool. I get to ask anybody anything, you know? I'll use it in a book or something. And as long as it's like, how do you communicate that you're going to transport? Since I was like, well, I think, you know, I was wondering if you could bring down like 4 cakes for the birthday party next week. It's like, yeah, so do you want like Afghan cakes or would you rather have a train wreck cake? You know, it's like, or how about a purple granddaddy cake? You want one of those? But so this point is, you know, they develop a language that allows them to communicate within the panopticon. And so I would look to criminal organizations of various sorts. And also, if you're going to consider organizing underground, ask yourself, would I trust my life to this person? Because that's what you're doing. And, you know, when I ask myself that in my own life, there's probably only couple, three people I would trust my life to. Because a lot of the people, the green scare people, have gone away for 20 years. And that's a big chunk of your life. And so how do you know who to trust? You gotta think about this. It's like, are they... How do they get vouched for? You know, we don't right now have the luxury. The way they do this in real resistance movements is give somebody a gun and say, okay, go kill a member of the opposition. That's how they did in German in the World War II resistance against Germans. Go shoot a German. Real easy. German guy's not going to do it. German woman probably wouldn't do it either. And so the point is that how do you trust the people? You know, it's like, I think we can say that I'm not a Fed. If I'm a Fed, I've written 15 books. It's like, that's really fucking deep cover. that doesn't mean you have to trust me. You know, I may be a wimp and I may turn. As soon as the cops put me in the car, I may turn. So you can't trust me for that reason. But you can say I'm not a Fed. Okay, so now you could probably say my mom's not a Fed because, you know, I would know my... You see what I'm saying? So how do you know who to trust? You have to think about these things. And I did an interview with a pacifist one time, which was a big mistake. And... one of the things he said in his inaccurate write-up was, it seems like Derek wants for all activists to think like assassins. And that's not true. I only want for some activists to think like assassins. And what I want is for all activists to think like members of a serious resistance. And what does that mean? One of the things it means is paying attention to the panopticon, not letting the panopticon scare you. You know, I haven't said it tonight, but a lot of times on my talks I say, you know, for the undercover Fed agent in the audience, I have a couple things to say to you. One of them is, fuck you. And the other one is, I want for it to be known publicly that what you're doing is wrong. And when Adolf Eichmann was on trial for his life in Jerusalem, part of his defense was that nobody ever told him what he was doing was wrong. Well, I'm telling you what you're doing is wrong. I'm telling you in public. And I'm telling you that at some point you will be held accountable for your crimes against humanity and in the favor of corporations. I say that publicly because I'm above ground, so it's my job to put on a big fucking bullseye. But below ground, I got a friend who says, if you want to be a revolutionary, don't look like one. He wears suits and ties. You know? It's like, your job, it depends on the rule. How do you organize underground? Ask marijuana growers. And you know what? If they have good security, they won't tell you. Ha. They'll say, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't smoke. Oh, I want to say one thing about marijuana. I got to tell you a story. I love this story. I live in Northern California, obviously, and there was a great example of participatory democracy happened about a year ago. What?
I think I called.
Okay. We're probably about done anyway.
It's 10 after 10.
Okay. Anyway, this is a story of participatory democracy having to do with marijuana, which is that the county where I live, everybody knows about Prop 215 in California? Oh, yeah. Prop 215 says you can grow and possess small amounts of marijuana for personal medicinal use. And it's determined by the county how much you get to have. And Del Norte, the county where I live, the rule used to be that you could have up to 99 plants. And there are those who said that somehow 99 plants is too much for personal medicinal use. And so the county was going to reduce it to 6 plants. The Board of Supervisors, that's the county commission. I don't know what you have here, but at home it's the Board of Supervisors. Anyway, so they were going to reduce it to 6 plants. The county turned out en masse. This was participatory democracy in action. The place was absolutely packed. If the Board of Supervisors would have reduced it to 6, they would have been killed that night. You know, this is what participatory democracy is supposed to look like. They said, fuck no, you are not taking our marijuana away from us. And that's the good news. The bad news is I wish that they would do the same thing for the salmon. You know, I wish they loved salmon as much as they love marijuana. When they are going to do something to salmon, you know, there's 4 people show up, and it's the same 4 people who showed up to protest the war. But anyway, that's the answer. Do you want to quit or do you want to do any more?
I'm tired, too.
You were going to ask a question a while ago. So your last question, is that okay? Is it a good ending question?
It was a response to Peterson.
Please laugh. Does anybody have a good ending question? You, because he's about one of my neighbors, so he gets special treatment.
It's actually not even a question. It was just a statement that I think everybody here should be aware of, keeping in mind of like the panopticon and whatnot. It is a good idea to read the news about certain criminal trials For instance, you can find out that if the feds decide it, if you have a battery in your cell phone, they can tape it. They can record what you're saying. It doesn't matter if the phone's on or not. And things like that, I think, are really important to realize. I mean, we're all like, oh, the security camera. And meanwhile, we all got cell phones, so who gives a shit if the camera's on? You know, they can hear every word. So I think it is very important, even if you're, I mean, if you're above ground, below ground, you know, whatever you're doing, I think it is really important to just be aware of these things. And I found out by reading an article about a mob case that happened, and that was the... That's how they got them.
And that's right. And it's absolutely crucial. People should always think security culture, security culture, security culture. You see, above ground groups sometimes fall apart because different people accuse each other of being snitches. That's one of the things. I got accused of being a snitch not very long ago. And it's really stupid because, like, there's right now there's an entirely above ground organization in Humboldt County that's falling apart because they're accusing each other of being snitches. It's like, wait, you're an above ground organization. It doesn't matter if there's snitches here. Because what do you do? You're having fucking bake sales, you know? It's like...
Well, but it's a brownie bake sale.
Yeah, it's brownie. Yeah. And so, yeah, if you're below ground, that's one thing. If you're above ground, I mean, it really doesn't matter if there is a Fed here tonight because none of us have said anything illegal. And you know what? Anybody who says anything actually illegal in here tonight is stupid enough. They should fucking go to prison. You know, it's like, you should go to prison for being stupid, you know? So we need to always keep in mind security culture. And if you're, another thing is the Black Panthers. There are a lot of those who are in prison who said, when I joined the Panthers, I knew I was either going to end up dead or in prison. And so if you go underground, you know, recognize that's one of the problems with the Green Scare is some of them, absolutely dedicated, not saying anything against them, Stan, I will be glad to say things against, fucking snitch. He snitched within 30 seconds of being in the cop car. He got in the cop car and he turned. Clearly, he had not recognized that if you burn down federal facilities, you're committing a crime. And you need to be aware that those in power will do something to you if you commit crimes they don't like. And so if you're going to, that's another thing. This is not a game. The world is being killed. We need to fight back. We need to make a culture of resistance. We need to, and we need to live our own lives as if our own lives matter. That's what all this has to do with what's real, you know? Live your own life as if your own life is real and meaningful. And then also fight back because your own life and the lives of others depend on it.
That's that whole integrity thing. I mean, that whole alignment. That's where the power comes from. I mean, the power comes from that alignment of what you believe. I always tell people, if you believe that you need to recycle and you don't recycle, ooh. You know, you can see people's energy just dripping off. I can see it just dripping off of their body. And they'll throw recycling over to me and I say, look, I already recycle. I already got my power on that. I don't need to worry about it. That's why every little thing you do every day is this power thing, you know, I think it's great, obviously. And when you have integrity, it's just cool, because people can't say to you, well, you shouldn't do this, or you shouldn't do that, or whatever, because, like, you know what you're doing. And I didn't get this till much later in life, but it's great to just know what you're doing, and people can't say, oh, you can't do that, or you didn't do that, and it's your personal experience. They can't say that. When you have personal experience, nobody can tell you that that's not true. Nobody can say you didn't have that experience. Nobody. I don't care who it is. And it's a very powerful way to live.
Which doesn't mean that you can't be a hypocrite.
Oh.
Because we're all hypocrites. Yeah, absolutely. I did this great, we don't have time to do it, but I did this great thing in Chico the other day, which is we all went around the room, it's like 50 of us, we all went around the room saying the things that we do that are impure, and not saying like confessional, but it's like, I love potato chips. Like, especially potato chips made in lard. I can hold a bag. I like playing Half-Life 2. Pretty damn good game. I like betting on professional sports. You know, so fucking what? I mean, that doesn't mean that I'm not going to bring down the whole fucking culture. You know, so it's like, that's another thing they do is they get us. I'm not saying we should, but of course we have, but that's because I have integrity on that, because it's like, I don't give a shit.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I can't throw away paper that hasn't been written on every little itty bit because I
can see that.
Yeah. And, so what's the point? The point is that, that we will be, we shouldn't feel like hypocrites also, because we have to somehow, on some level, participate in a system that was foisted upon us. What we need to do is to move through that system with as much integrity as we can, and at the same time recognize, I didn't make this system, and I need to bring it down.
You can grow tomatoes and throw rocks.
Which is a great note to end on. We need to thank Stephanie one more time, because she did this all by herself.